We're going to come to order, so please take your seats. We'll start. So, good morning. My name is David Nahai. I serve as the chair of the Los Angeles Regional Water Board, and today is Thursday, April 23rd. It is 9:02 a.m., and I'm calling the meeting to order. For people who only want to listen to or watch the meeting, the board's customary website webcast is available. There is a direct link to the webcast on the meeting agenda posted on our website. In addition, we're receiving presentations and public comments through a Zoom meeting platform and in person. For this board meeting, interpretation services will not be available. Please note that all Los Angeles Regional Water Board meetings, there is no expectation of privacy regarding any communications. Meetings are recorded and names of participants are listed in the Zoom forum. Participation in a recorded meeting will be deemed consent to be recorded. So next we'll move on to the roll call and the declaration of our quorum. So could we please have the roll call, Ms. Rowe?
Vice Chair Ashion?
Present.
Board Member Camacho?
Present.
Board Member Christensen?
Present.
Board Member Mendez?
Present.
Chair Nahai?
Here.
Roll call completed. Thank you.
Thank you. Next item is the order of the agenda. And please note that agenda items are numbered for identification purposes only and may not necessarily be considered in this order. I'll ask our Executive Officer, Susana Arredondo, if there are any changes to the order of the agenda.
Chair, there are no changes to the order of the agenda. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Item 3 is the approval of the draft meeting minutes for the March 26, 2026 meeting. So I'll ask for a motion for the adoption of the approval of the draft meeting minutes for March 26, 2026. Do I have a motion?
So moved.
Okay, moved by Vice Chair Ashton.
And I second.
And second from Board Member Camacho. So I have a motion and a second. Let's have the roll call vote, please.
Vice Chair Ashton?
Yes.
Board Member Camacho?
Yes.
Board Member Christensen?
Yes.
Board Member Mendez?
Yes.
Chair Nahai?
Yes.
Motion carries. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Next item, item number 4, are board member communications. I'll ask first if there are any ex parte disclosures to be made by any of the board members. I'll start with Board Member Christensen.
None at this time.
Okay. Board Member Camacho?
None.
Board Member Mendez.
The only thing is on my social media feed, I don't know the algorithm, I got a couple reels of the Santa Susana parents and the Santa Susana. So I did watch one of the reels, and then the subsequent ones I did not. And it was just generally about the Boeing issue.
And just to flag, today's Santa Susana item is not an adjudicate proceeding, so that was that's fine.
Okay, thank you. Vice Ashton?
None, thank you.
Okay, and I have no ex parte disclosures to report. So next we'll go to board member reports. Board members may discuss communications, correspondence, or other items of general interest relating to matters within the board's jurisdiction. We'll start with Board Member Christensen.
Yes, thank you. I had the pleasure and the privilege of traveling with SoCal grant makers up to Sacramento a couple of weeks ago to meet with a series of funders and staff members at the CNRA. And while most of what we discussed was broadly wildfire and climate, we did also hear a little bit from water board staff about the planning activities that we've heard about from board member Firestone. And it was a heartening day to hear and to see from a number of different departments across the state. All of the efforts, all of the legislative pushes, all of the current budget discussions that are happening that really are committing further funding to both wildfire resilience as well as the recovery here in LA and climate efforts in general. And I'm hearing more and more that you know, we've long seen sort of conservation and climate in their own silos and wildfire in its own silo and water and so on. And I had the pleasure of spending some time with Secretary Crowfoot's new science advisor that CCST has loaned him. And I was really happy to hear that his focus is on, or one of his foci points is on merging the 30 by 30 conservation efforts with climate benefits with wildfire resilience. And I think that this kind of layered approach is something that we need right now in this time, and it gave me hope. That's it for me.
Yes, I just wanted to recognize and thank Jenny Newman and her staff for their participation at the Water Quality Permitting Consortium on April 16th. It was a really good meeting. I think a lot of good dialogue happened and a lot of collaboration to be had for the future. And so thank you guys, and your expertise was very well delivered there and well accepted.
Board Member Mendez.
Yes, thank you again to staff and everyone of the work that they do here, including our key stakeholders in the audience, and want to wish everyone a belated happy Earth Day. I had the pleasure of being a keynote speaker at a community college, so it's always interesting, and I'm honored to be able to engage with students at the community college level, not just at the four-year university. And there were some very, to keep us hopeful, there was a great group of students interested from STEM, environmental science, to urban planning, and even environmental humanities. So as in these dark times where things are getting rolled back at the national level or even in the global geopolitical issues, it's great to see a group of students, many of them working full-time and still attending school and caring about the environment. So again, happy belated Earth Day.
Thank you. Vice Chair Ashton.
Yes, I was also going to wish everyone a happy Earth Day, happy Earth Month. I hope that you've been taking advantage of all of the activities that have been going on in the region. There have been some wonderful events from a lot of the NGOs and government entities. So hope you're all enjoying and getting outdoors. Last night, I had the opportunity to attend the Environmental Working Group's Earth Day celebration, and I just wanted to note their they have a tap water database that is fantastic for getting a sense of your tap water, the chemicals that are contained in the water, or the cleanliness of it. And it's a very helpful resource that's free and covers so many areas. I also wanted to share that I had the opportunity to attend with our executive officer, as well as a couple of the staff who've been working on this project, the Pure Water Las Virgenes Triunfo groundbreaking ceremony a couple of weeks ago, and it was very exciting to see that project starting to come to fruition after years of planning, and to see the collaboration and the innovation that's been occurring amongst so many partners in this space. So to see this really come to fruition, and to see the Pure Water projects just generally around the region start to actually happen is really exciting. And then finally, with our Assistant Executive Officer, Jenny Newman, and I attended the Santa Monica Bay Restoration Commission meeting last week. That's a commission that I sit on as the representative for this board. And our state board member, or our state staff provided a working group information item about post-fires and ways of best practices and collaboration amongst the state, and it was really informative and educational, and it's great to see the work that's happening in that space. So that's it for me. Thank you. Thank you.
Perfect. Thank you. Yeah, I'll wish everybody a happy Earth Day. I actually wish everybody a happy Earth these days. And actually, you know, seeing the pictures that were sent back by the Artemis probe to the moon, it should hopefully remind all of us what a precious blue planet we live on. And I wish that our political leaders around the world would have some understanding of that. My own granddaughter sent me a little picture. She's like 5 years old, that she's become a water protector at her school, and she wanted to send me that, which you know. So you know what? Maybe there is hope for the future after all. Apparently, she scolded her mother when her mother was brushing her teeth, that her mom was using too much water brushing her teeth. So, you know, I liked it, although my daughter wasn't too appreciative of that. I have one thing to report. I attended a press conference with the mayor and many, many other people last Thursday. This is for the launch of the wastewater recycling plant at Tillman. And it was a very well-attended event, the mayor, two council members, the heads of, you know, LADWP, LA Sanitation Environment, BOE, and it was again just very hopeful to be there to see the city moving in the direction of building more towards the momentum of wastewater recycling, and this coming on the heels of the ribbon cutting that we had at Hyperion, that was attended also by our EO Susanna Arredondo and our AEO Jenny Newman. Again, a small step at Hyperion, but nevertheless a significant one. So lots of hope, I think, for the future. Okay, that's it from me. We'll move on now to item number 5, which is the executive officer's report. Ms. Arredondo?
Thank you, Chair. I do have a few updates for our board. Our participation in the Los Angeles County Sanitation District's 18th Annual Earth Day event on April 11th of 2026, the regional program staff from the TMDL and Nonpoint Source and MS4 units participated in Los Angeles County Sanitation District's 18th Annual Earth Day event. This event was held at the LA County Sanitation's Joint Administration Office in collaboration with the Clean Water Works Education Foundation. This was a free community event that had over 500 green exhibitors facilitating tours, arts and crafts, live music and dance. The event drew more than 1,500 attendees. Regional program staff worked at an informational booth for the event, highlighting some of the work of the board. The booth was anchored by a large map of the region where visitors were encouraged to mark their favorite local water body. Top favorites included Whittier Narrows, Santa Monica Beaches, and the Long Beach Coast. At the booth, staff had flyers with Water Board's mission and restoration efforts in the San Gabriel River, and activity books, stickers, and tattoos for the kids. Furthermore, staff answered questions from attendees of all ages about local water bodies, Water Board projects, and water-related employment opportunities. This is currently, in this fiscal year, this is the second outreach tabling event regional program staff has participated in, and staff looks forward to more events in the future. The second update I have for you is, like Board Member Camacho mentioned, the Los Angeles Water Quality Permitting Consortium workshop. On April 16th of 2026, regional programs and watershed regulatory section staff participated in the Los Angeles Water Quality Permitting Consortium workshop Number two, the workshop was hosted by Los Angeles County Department of Public Works and brought together groundwater basin stakeholders from across Los Angeles County, along with staff from the state and Lahontan Regional Water Boards. These groups exchange information on salt and nutrient management plans, or SNPs, and other groundwater salinity solutions. Participants discussed current permitting and SNP management challenges and explored potential strategies to improve both SNP implementation and project permitting. During the workshop, the groundwater basin representatives provided both updates on SMP development and on various pure water projects. In addition, the representatives shared questions related to recycled water project permitting and ongoing SMP management. In response, Water Board staff clarified the purpose and role of the SMP in explaining its benefits of having it and steps in expediting and expediting the permitting of general and site-specific projects, outlining key SMP-related tasks and addressing questions regarding SMP data assessment and future updates. The next consortium workshop is tentatively scheduled for the fall of 2026, and this will focus on the process memo 97-005 that provides a framework for the Division of Drinking Water to evaluate set permit conditions and approve the use of impaired groundwater sources for drinking water. And my last update for the board is the 10th Annual Environmental Justice and Enforcement Symposium. On April 15th of 2026, the LA Water Board Surface Water and Groundwater Division staff, along with Cal EPA and our sister agencies, attended the 10th anniversary of the Environmental Justice and Enforcement Symposium held at the California Endowment. The event focused on advancing equity in environmental protection and strengthening enforcement strategies. The symposium brought together policymakers, advocates, and experts to reflect on a decade of progress while addressing ongoing environmental justice challenges in impaired communities. The keynote speaker, LA County District Attorney Nathan Hotchman, he spoke on the role of his office in environmental cases. His remarks underscored the importance of accountability for environmental harm and the need for strong, coordinated enforcement moving forward. And this concludes my update. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Any questions for the executive officer? Okay, hearing none. We'll go on to our next item, which is our update from State Water Board, from our liaison, Board Member Laurel Firestone.
Hi, good to see you all. Glad to be here today. Can you all hear me okay? I think there's a little echo on my on my end, but that's okay. I wanted to speak first just briefly to a request that Board Member Camacho had around, just a quick update to the hydrologic update I gave in March. Sorry, I have something in my throat. As we've seen this year, there's just been extreme, going from one extreme to another. We had some of the wettest, as you remember, some of the wettest October through December period ever observed in parts of Santa Barbara, Ventura, Kern, and parts of LA County this winter. And then it went into some of the, well, by far the hottest and driest March on record in much of California, but by far the hottest across California and the broader West. And that really melted or evaporated nearly all the snow, the vast majority of snow that was dropped earlier by storms, so that we ended up with one of the lowest snowpack readings on record once we got to April. Since April, there's been some more storms, especially in the Sierra portions, like the northern and Sierra portions of the state, and some cooler temperatures, but our Sierra Nevada snowpack still remains in a virtual dead heat with the 2015 lowest on record to date snowpack, even though we've had much higher precipitation than in 2015. And then important to this region, we are seeing by far the lowest on record snowpack for the Upper Colorado River Basin. And so that, I would say this is in some ways what we would expect from climate change, overall warmer temperatures, but mostly more extremes, and moving from having these extremes to becoming more and more that being the new normal. Unfortunately, and it means that our hydrologic, that our their water supply systems need to adjust to this change in hydrology of less snowpack, especially. So we'll keep, I'm happy to keep folks updated, but that's how the water year is evolving so far. Let's see, at the state board, we've been busy. We, first of all, I forwarded to the executive officer, and I know she shared it with you all, that we did finalize the state board's annual priorities. And this is kind of, it's like a annual work plan that really outlines what we expect to get over the finish line this calendar year, and what are the top priorities for us programmatically and in the coming years that we're focusing on in terms of our work this year. We also have information on just our core workload that needs to continue and is sort of unsung but vital in the core work that we do. So that's posted on our website if anyone's interested. We've been really busy with SGMA. So we returned another subbasin, the Delta Mendota groundwater subbasin, to DWR's jurisdiction because they've done so much improvements to their groundwater sustainability plan and coordination across the basin that we felt that was warranted to go back to DWR's jurisdiction. Sorry, we also adopted some minimal impact exclusions for the two basins that are in probation currently. So that's Tulare Lake and the Tule groundwater basins. And we declined to give more exclusions generally for that. We've also issued a draft decision on the draft and draft permit for Sites Reservoir. We're accepting written comments on that through May 22nd. And the Delta Conveyance Project proceedings is also proceeding. There'll be a lot of hearing dates throughout the month of June. And there's been a lot of evidentiary and other filings that have been going on. A big thing that we did in hold a workshop on Mono Lake and the UCLA Center for Climate Science model that analyzed how varying climate change and water export scenarios impact Water Lake, Mono Lake. And that is released on our website. Encourage folks to take a look at that. But it's really examining why we failed to reach the state mandated target level for the lake level. And what we're going to be doing is over the next several months is be working on locally and regionally focused workshops to try to discuss more how we should be scoping out a likely hearing for how we need to adjust what is the order that we issued that has not been successful in reaching the lake level that was needed. So we're still scoping that out. There's a lot of opportunities for workshops and participation, and those are all posted on our Mono Lake webpage. And I just also encourage folks to email, get on the email list. I know this is an important issue for this region. And let's see, other things just to mention, we adopted the Prop 4 U.S.-Mexico border funding, and we had a workshop on the proposal for the Clean Water State Revolving Fund. So encourage folks that are interested in that to take a look. There's still a lot of process before we adopt the intended use plan, which is our annual guidelines for and plan for how we're using the state revolving fund money. There's still time for a workshop for planned for May 19th. Let's see. Oh, sorry. I think we haven't actually released that, but we will in the next several days. So keep an eye out for that. And then let's see. There was a draft recommendations of the Ag Expert Panel. And I know I've talked about this in the past. We held a workshop, a public workshop on that. That will be finalized, and comments are due on April 30th, but that will be finalized, and then there will be a workshop at the state board, likely in June. I'll keep folks updated on that once that's finalized. And I think those are the things I wanted to highlight for this board, but I'm happy to answer any questions.
There's so much happening. Thank you. thanks very much for that. As always, very, very comprehensive report. We so appreciate it. Thank you. Are there questions for Board Member Forrestone? No. All right, very impressive, all of the work that you're doing. Thank you so much for your report.
Thank you.
Thanks very much. Okay, we're going to move on now to a public forum. And here, any person may address the board regarding any matter within the board's jurisdiction, providing the matter does not appear elsewhere on the agenda, has not been scheduled to appear on a future agenda, and is not expected to be imminently scheduled for the board's consideration. So each speaker will have 3 minutes to address the board unless additional time has been approved in advance. Note that comments during public forum should be on items that are not pending or scheduled to appear on a future agenda and which are not otherwise on today's agenda. I want to stress that speakers are to keep their remarks to 3 minutes unless otherwise directed, unless otherwise allowed by the chair. At the conclusion of the time, microphones will be turned off to ensure the meeting proceeds in an orderly, equitable manner with proper decorum. So the order of speakers will be first speakers who are here in person, then speakers who are going to join virtually who have registered in advance, but third, other registered remote speakers who are registered in advance, and I'll ask them to raise their Zoom hand. So let's start with our speakers who are here in advance, in person. So Mr. Ray Tahir of TES Environment for 5 minutes. We'll start the 5 minutes when the slides are up.
Sorry about that. Next slide, please. Oh, no. We're good right here. Non-point source trash order is a continuation. The board still has not responded to the Gardena Democratic Club's request to discuss the order, which is subject to an administrative petition. The order is clearly defective on several levels. One is that it requires compliance with Water Code Section 132441, which requires compliance with water quality objectives under 132401. It does not apply to this or any other order. 132401 requires the following factors to be considered by the Regional Board, and all of you are familiar with these, so why don't just glide past it. The NPS order obviously cannot comply with 13241. Even if it were a requirement, the board would have to adopt a basin plan water quality objective, which would then require approval by the state board. The board should reopen the order and rescind it. Remember that the board adopted the order 5-0, so the board has collective responsibility. Next slide, please. I want to make clear that staff should not have been responsible for this order. They were not trained in this area, and it's apparent that Chair Nahai pushed staff in adopting the order. As an attorney having been appointed to the board on multiple occasions, he should have known that 13241 does not apply and that the order duplicates point source trash mitigation BMPs. Legal counsel should also have caught the 13241 error after reviewing it. I suspect that the order was not motivated to protect water quality, but instead was motivated by non-ideological reasons. Next slide, please. ROWD, what is it? It's a reapplication for an MPDS permit or MPDS individual permit that must be submitted every 5 years. It proposes requirements to comply with federal regulations, and we can go past all of this. The ROWD, as mentioned, should have been submitted by March 15th, 2026. Missing the deadline is no small matter. According to an MOU between US EPA and the state, the ROWD must be submitted in a timely manner. There has been no indication from the board counsel or the board chair when permittees will be provided instructions on how to comply with the ROWD, which was the case in April of 2017. According to the current MS4 permit, the due date for the next permit is September 11, 2026. Because the ROWD was not submitted by the deadline date, my guess is that the 2026 MS4 permit won't be adopted until sometime in 2027. I will provide more ROW-related information at the May meeting. Next slide, please. It's also likely that the next permit will not carry over the same requirements associated with the current permit, such as the watershed management programs. The unfunded mandate commission last December ruled that these programs were purely voluntary and that primary compliance is determined by the stormwater management programs and TMDLs translated into numeric water quality-based effluent limitations, which are determined at outfalls. Also note that several court decisions will impact the permit in terms of reduced requirements. They include the Supreme Court's elimination of the Chevron Doctrine and the decision in the City and County of San Francisco versus US EPA and the Fifth Circuit Court's decision on toxicity testing.
And I just want to flag that since this slide involves issues in the next pending permit, it's an ex parte communication will be added.
That doesn't apply, and you know it doesn't apply.
Mr. Tahir, please
no,
don't.
You need to reread it. We already went through this.
Please
it doesn't apply, and
me.
Don't interrupt
I'm just
me.
Saying it's going to be added to the administrative record, and your clock has been paused.
I'll do it at the end.
So it's not affecting your time.
You know, you've done this before, jumping in unnecessarily. All right? You need to talk to your boss about this. Anyway.
Don't worry, I have.
Yeah. Well, we'll see. Port of Cologne requirements affecting board members. 13292 requires boards to behave in a manner that assures fairness and due process. I raise this because Mr. Nahai has not been fair or complied with due process. As an example of the former, Mr. Nahai has criticized me at the March board meeting for exceeding my three-minute presentation by a few seconds, which has been caused by delays and slide transitions. Yet Mr. Nahai did not hold Burbank's deputy director to this limit during his presentation on the temperature water quality objective. He went over his prescribed limit by over a minute and 14 seconds. Given the importance of the presentation, it seems it's warranted. Mr. Nahai's application of the strict time limit on me was for retribution, for me opposing the NPS order and challenging his suggestions of enforcing TMDLs as a priority for this year. Conflict of interest. Board members should not participate in any proceeding before a regional board of the state board as a consultant or any other capacity on behalf or any other discharger. This should apply to Mr. Nahai as he is considered a consultant. In conclusion, vous comprenez, Monsieur Nye? Attendez-vous? Thank you.
I do have a question.
Go ahead.
Regarding the Gardena Democratic Party, mm-hmm. Can you tell me if there was a board vote of the board to submit that letter? Because I've been
yes.
on their website. It's not up to date. Are they currently a charter Democratic club?
Yes.
So it would be important to have the board member.
That can be done.
Yes.
That can be done.
Because right now it seems like it's not a chartered Democratic club. There's no website. It hasn't been updated for years.
Well, they've been.
And there's no discussion of this issue on this.
Well, that
so
can
typically,
be
don't interrupt me. Typically, when you have a board organization submit a letter, that board member or the representative comes to speak on their behalf. So that has not happened.
Okay.
So you continually bring them up, and there's no evidence that they are having issues with this topic.
Well, I'll have them give you a call.
No, have them present themselves here to
well,
our
they'll
board.
Do it virtually. They won't have to come here because both of them are semi-invalid. Understand?
Okay. So that's clear.
Got it.
Okay, let's go on. I have three registered speakers virtually. First, we will hear from Mr. Stanley Hunter for 3 minutes. Mr. Hunter, can you hear us?
Mr. Hunter, can you unmute yourself?
Okay, I'll move on to the next card I have, and maybe we'll come back to Mr. Hunter if he can be on. Next is from Mr. Walter Lamb for 3 minutes.
Good morning, board members. Walter Lamb speaking on behalf of the Bidewinds Land Trust.
Good morning.
Sounds like there's a little bit of an echo. As you recall, in December, you asked your staff to prepare and submit a letter to CDFW regarding the Bino Wetlands TMDLs. I did receive a copy of that letter on Tuesday, and so I wanted to thank staff for sending me a copy of that letter. It did take 4 months to create what is a 2.5-page letter. I would strongly encourage all of the board members to read it. I think the piece that we found most interesting, so I didn't include it here, but there was a date of September 30th, 2026, as the date by which the revised EIR should be recertified. There wasn't any indication of what would happen if that date wasn't met. Doesn't seem to have any sort of regulatory effect. But following that, it said, in addition, upon recertification of the EIR, CDFW should propose a schedule. And then there's four bulleted items, and we were very interested to see that because these are the things that we've been asking for to be incorporated into a TMDL schedule. And so this is the first record after, you know, 3+ years of coming and trying to get some discussion on these points that now we finally, I think, have out in the open that, yes, this is important and we do need a schedule for these points. I guess the question we would ask, though, is, Why would it be more efficient to wait until recertification of the EIR for a project in which the EIR itself would presumably, you know, want to be taking into account how long it's going to take to do the project, right? And you certainly, as the overseers of the TMDLs, would probably want to know what are all the obstacles that need to be overcome? How long would it take for each obstacle to be overcome, and how much money would that cost? Given that we just went through a roughly 3-year period in which the Department of Fish and Wildlife was seeking $1.8 million and never actually received it, and so then shifted to do the work internally, when there are much more expensive tasks coming up, we could be looking at, you know, you just look at the trajectory, 30, 40 years. I would just like to get an understanding of when the board thinks the TMDLs would be implemented on a decade level, right? Do you, I mean, it's obviously not this decade. Do you think it will be next decade, the 2040s, 2050s? I think waiting until the EIR is certified to have this information just continues to create problems. And I would just ask you to ask for this information at your May meeting as an informational item. It's fairly straightforward, a schedule for these four bulleted things. And thank you very much for your time today.
Thank you. Thank you for your comments. Okay. Next card I have is from Ms. Teresa Kelly for 3 minutes. Sean? No? Is Mr. Stanley Hunter around? No, Khalid? Okay. All right.
He's online, but look like he's muted.
Okay. Are there any others who are in the Zoom meeting who may wish to comment? If so, please raise your Zoom hand. All right. Okay. Well, we'll move on then. The next item on the agenda are uncontested items. And we have one uncontested item, which is item 8. This is a tentative amendment of waste discharge requirements for the Newhall Land and Farming Company proposed resource management and development plan and spineflower conservation plan in Santa Clarita, LA County. So this item is uncontested. I can ask for a motion and a second.
So moved.
Okay, we have a motion from Vice Chair Ashton, a second from Board Member Christensen. Let's call the roll.
Vice Chair Ashton?
Yes, thank you.
Board Member Camacho?
Yes.
Board Member Christensen?
Yes.
Board Member Mendez?
Yes.
Chair Nahai?
Yes.
Motion carries. Thank you.
Thank you. We'll move on now to item number 9, which is the consideration of a tentative resolution approving a proposed special study for Los Angeles County Sanitation District's AK Warren Water Resource Facility. So there, I understand that there's no staff introduction for this, so we're going to hear a presentation from Mr. Joshua Westfall, who's the senior environmental scientist for LA County Sanitation Districts.
Good morning. Is our presentation up? Thank you. Okay, we'll jump right in. Good morning, Mr. Chair, board members. Thank you for the opportunity to be here this morning. We're pretty excited to share a little update with you on our proposed special study for 2026 for our AK Warren facility. To orient you a little bit, on the map, you should be pretty familiar with the Los Angeles County Sanitation Districts. We're going to be focused on the area that's circled towards the bottom of this slide. That's our Warren facility. That is the source of our single ocean discharge, and it's also connected via the lines that you see coming upwards from it to our joint outfall system. That area that does have influence from all of those, again, that's going to go out to the ocean, and we're going to be doing some work associated with that in terms of ocean water quality. All right, we've got this figured out. Now, some background information on the project itself. SCWRP, the Southern California Coastal Water Research Project, along with various partners, has been working on what's called the Roms-Beck Ocean Model. It's a big physical and biogeochemical model that can look at a whole lot of characteristics going into the water, the ocean, and looking at the biological or biogeochemical impacts from them. The goal, or at least how it's being used currently, is to better understand the coastal impacts of nutrients from anthropogenic sources, of which a POTW discharge is a significant one. Now, there are two types of data that are going to be used for model inputs or model validation once that model's been complete. There's empirical data. When we talk about empirical data, it's things that we go out, we see, we measure, we report back. In the lack of empirical data, you're going to look to things like expert consensus, which may be best professional judgment, looking at trends, looking at historical data, that sort of thing. The idea here, though, is that the better your data are, and we'll go back to this theme, the better your empirical data sets are, the better your application, better your model data is likely to be. One example that's kind of spurring this is over on the right-hand side. Now, if you look at output from this model, it's a whole lot more dynamic and complex than this little screenshot that we're giving here. But what you do see is a nice highlight where, under certain conditions, the area that you see in light green, under current conditions with anthropogenic influences, you're seeing an area where there's a silica limitation. The idea is that silica limitation may be contributing to, you know, certain other natural, potentially harmful oceanic conditions. We'd like to understand this better. Now, how we plan to move forward with approval is a two-year study, which we would be commencing this July, obviously moving on for 2 years. And what we're aiming to do is, in a nutshell, make for better input data. Now, there's nothing incredibly flashy about what we're doing here. Instead, we contend that we're doing the critical background work to make sure that the model is functioning as well as possible. So what we'll be doing is a better characterization of the effluent that's discharged to the ocean. That's looking at your nutrients from nitrogen, phosphorus, and silica, which we did look at in the last slide, which a lot of us didn't realize was such a critical or potentially limiting nutrient in the ocean until we saw some of this model output, which provides the advantage of the model is able to be everywhere all the time. We can't do that physically. So a lot of these things we are currently looking at in the effluent, maybe we're not doing them as often as we propose to do. Some of them are just novel analytes, such as the silicate. In addition to that, we are aiming to add quarterly receiving water monitoring. We'll give you a little peek as to where that was proposed as we move forward. And we would be doing that at the surface, at the level in the water column where there's the highest chlorophyll A content, and then at the maximum depth, and doing that for 5 stations. The idea behind the monthly effluent monitoring is simply better inputs for the model, with the idea that better input equals better output. In terms of the receiving water monitoring, we'd like to test it as much as we can, you know, with the limited resources that we have. And so we would be looking at the same analyte list in the receiving water environment to see how are the model predictions working out. I mentioned that we would be doing this at 5 stations. We have those circled on the map that's in front of you. The rationale behind the station selection is that one station was selected to be within our zone of initial dilution. One station is within a marine protected area. The other 3 stations were selected to provide us a nice balance of spatial and depth coverage. What we're trying to get out of this, I can't state it enough. The final point, that the better input you have, the better output you have, the more certainty, the more buy-in you have into this model. So we aim to provide the data that we come up with through this study to SCWRP and the UCLA modeling team so that they can make model improvements, model validation efforts, that sort of thing. This would involve improving the characterization of our Warren facility effluent for use as an input to the Roms-Beck. And then, as I said, that we would hope to attain some additional validation of the modeled output using our receiving waters. And ultimately, a side benefit of this is the potential to test this sort of an approach for better characterization of the inputs and determine maybe it would be a good model for other dischargers to use. That is what we're aiming to do, so I'm happy to entertain any questions.
Are there questions for Mr. Westphal? Go ahead, please.
Yeah, I just had a clarifying question in terms of the data that's provided. Once it gets to SQRP, is that going to be available for public consumption, or how does the public get to that?
Yes. In addition to all data that we collect as the sanitation districts being publicly available, all data from the SQRP project will be made public through a separate means, through essentially data that's collected and connected to the ROMSpec study. So, yes.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thanks. Appreciate it. Thank you. All right. We're going to move now to item number 10, which is the update on the San Gabriel River temperature study conducted by the Los Angeles County Sanitation Districts for the Pomona Water Reclamation Plant, the San Jose Water Reclamation Plant, the Whittier Narrows Water Reclamation Plant, the Los Coyotes Water Reclamation Plant, and the Long Beach Water Reclamation Plant. So a staff from LA County Sanitation Districts will present a summary of the results of the San Gabriel River temperature study.
We need to get a vote on the last item.
I'm sorry, what?
We need to get a vote on the last item.
Oh, you're so right. I thought that was a cheated it like an information item. My apologies for that. Okay. So going back to item number 9, could I have a motion for the approval of that item?
A motion to approve.
Thank you, Board Member Camacho.
Second.
And a second from Board Member Mendez. Could we have the roll call, please?
Vice Chair Ashion?
Yes, thank you.
Board Member Camacho?
Yes.
Board Member Christensen?
Yes.
Board Member Mendez?
Yes.
Chair Nahai?
Yes,
motion
thank you.
Motion carries. Thank you.
Thank you. Apologies for that. The New York Times had an article this morning about what medicines can cause dementia. So I looked at them with great interest and found that I'm not taking any of them, but perhaps I'm taking something else. My apologies to everybody for that. All right. Item number 10, I won't go through the litany. Again, we'll start with a staff introduction from AEO Jenny Newman.
Good morning, Chair Nahai and board members. This item is an update on the LA County Sanitation District's temperature study. So last month you heard from City of LA, LA San, about their temperature study for their wastewater treatment plants and the City of Burbank's wastewater treatment plant, their temperature study for the Los Angeles River. So like those plants, LA County Sanitation District's plants in the San Gabriel River all had their permits renewed recently, and the temperature limit in the permit was updated based on a new interpretation of our temperature water quality objective. The temperature limit was reduced from 86 to 80, and they were given a time schedule to come into compliance with that number. And part of this, they were given a compliance schedule, to use the right terms, to come into compliance with that 80 degree temperature limit. Part of the compliance schedule included opportunity for County Sanitation District to do a special study to look at the appropriateness of the 80-degree effluent limit and the underlying temperature water quality objective based on site-specific conditions in San Gabriel River watershed, and to look at various alternative compliance scenarios for the temperature objective. And LA County Sanitation District has is wrapping up that study. They started in 2023, I believe, and they're wrapping the study up, and they're ready to present the results to you. Once they're finished up with that study, we will work with them. Your staff will work with them to come up with a way to apply the results of the study to their permit and implementation of their permit. Like the LA River study, staff is not recommending that we do a amendment to the basin plan to revise the water quality objective for temperature based on their study, but we are committed to working with them on an appropriate permitting solution. So I just wanted to give you that overview to remind you of what we talked about last month and how it's carried over to this month for this separate set of water reclamation plants.
Okay, thank you very much. I think we're going to hear from Mr. Ferrante from LA County Sanitation Districts. Good morning.
Good morning, Chair Nahai and Board, and thank you for allowing us to be here and staff as well. Before I talk about the temperature study, I would like to thank the regional board staff for being at our Earth Day in Whittier. Part of our mission is public education, and it's great to collaborate on the importance of protecting our delicate water systems. And I do want to put in a plug. August 1st, we will have another festival at our A.K. Warren facility, specifically for the community there, and that's of course our main plant, so the community will be able to, and we'll have tours of the facility as well as educational booths and also a focus on ocean as well from that facility, whereas the Whittier was a little bit more of the rivers and upstream. The Carson one will focus more on the ocean, so invite all of you to come. That those are always great events, and hopefully this will be our first annual, one of many, but hopefully it'll be a success as well. So today I'm going to start and kind of give you an executive summary of the temperature studies we've done, and then to get into the details, we have our supervising engineer, Katie Marjanovic, who will go into the details of the study. So as Jenny mentioned, we did a really comprehensive temperature study looking at many different elements with regard to our discharges, obviously focused on biological evaluations of all the aquatic habitat upstream and downstream of our discharges. We looked at temperature monitoring data for the last 25 years that we have at multiple locations within the river, within our treatment plants as well. Part of this was also doing source investigations, looking at the influent that comes to our treatment plant and what happens to temperature through our treatment plant. Also looking at industries that discharge to us. Does anybody discharge something that's excessively hot? As Jenny says, too, we also looked at potential control options for temperature in order to meet the 80 degrees. Things, nature-based solutions, as well as mechanical or infrastructure solutions, chillers and cooling towers. All of this was done with facilitation by a scientist from SQIRP, the Southern California Coastal Water Environment Program or Program, Research Program. SQIRP, Dr. Eric Stein, who's spoken here before, and of course there was a group of stakeholders as well that reviewed the data. All of that information is publicly available. SQIRP has it on its web pages as well. So cutting a little bit to the end here, but it'll provide you background as Katie goes through her presentation. With respect to the biology, we saw no differences in the aquatic habitat upstream and downstream of our discharge points. We saw no difference in the fish communities. Unfortunately, all the fish were non-native. As we know, because of modifications in the rivers, we don't have native species. They really can't complete their life cycle within the changes that have occurred in that river from a natural condition with the dams and the lined concrete bottom. So we didn't really see any effluent temperature impact on the beneficial use of the biology. With regard to our data, unfortunately, during certain parts of the year, we did see that the river exceeds 80 degrees Fahrenheit. What we specifically saw is that whether it's the river or our influent, our effluent, that it tracks ambient temperatures. You know, even though you would think that, you know, the sewer system's running underground, that maybe it's a little cooler or it's different, it all tracks ambient temperatures. And you'll see from Katie's study that even the potable water system tracks ambient temperatures, which comes into people's homes underground as well. So ambient temperature, unfortunately, is the key. And of course, with that ambient temperature impact, even if we lowered our temperature to 80 when it was above, quickly the ambient temperature would, the heat transfer would occur in the river. These are not high flow rivers. Most of the flow is the water, our effluent, and as a result, it has a there's a big correlation between ambient temperature and our discharge. We looked at control measures, mechanical chillers, and I think you heard this from the LA study too. They'll meet permit requirements. Obviously, a lot of energy, a lot of infrastructure, a lot of cost associated with them for the chillers. Cooling towers do not meet at all times. They are a little less expensive, but still very expensive. So attaining the limit at the discharge point is energy intensive and very expensive. So obviously, you know, I'd like to bring good news and I like to bring positive news. And so, I mean, I do want to mention that there are a lot of things we can do with regard to temperature. First off, we will continue, obviously, and it's important to continue to monitor the river temperatures, our wastewater temperatures. We do not want any degradation. We do not want an industry coming in and then, you know, upping our temperatures or modification of our treatment processes that increase the temperature. So right now, our treatment plant really does not influence the temperature of the wastewater. What it comes in, it basically goes out at. So that's something that we can continue to do. And you know, I think you heard the state board member talk about the, you know, the swings in temperature. That's why I think it's important to collect data. We are in uncharted times with respect to our, whether it be ambient or aquatic systems, with respect to what's happening with them, not only with temperatures, but also currents and the regimes that are occurring. So it's important to continue to collect that data. Obviously, item two there, continue to do the biological monitoring that we do on an annual basis up and down the river to make sure that the habitat is not degrading, not only because of temperature, but of other things. So we will continue to collect that information and have that available for the watershed. Number three is very key. You know, no agency can do it alone. There are many people that are stakeholders to the, whether it be the LA River or the San Gabriel River, not only in terms of living in close proximity to them, but having a piece of that river, whether it's flood control, public works with respect to operation of the dams, others that are doing in proximity projects in proximity to the rivers as well, that we need to work with and continue to work with. There are opportunities to not only keep the habitat we have, but slowly improve upon it by removing invasive vegetation, being, and especially this is more for the riparian, for birds and other things, but being sensitive to those during nesting season and those types of things as well to make sure the existing habitat continues to thrive. And finally, I mean, every time, you know, I see an issue, whether it's ocean acidification, marine heat waves, and what's happening with the rivers, whether it be the San Gabriel or the Santa Clara, We as an agency and collectively, we need to prioritize fighting climate change. You'll see in the data that when ambient temperatures are lower, the river temperature is lower. And when the river temperature is lower, that's how it used to be, and that is native conditions. And likewise, the same effect for the ocean. So in everything we do, we do it with an eye towards sustainability with respect to our other projects. And also, for example, we have a goal of switching our fleet to 90% electric vehicles by 2030. We're well on our way to meeting that. Other projects that we're doing, of course, our pure water recycled project in an attempt to develop that local source so we don't have to import that water is going to be important. But everything needs to have a focus or a lens on climate change. And that's kind of my parting message, bigger message, I guess. And with that, I'll hand it off to Katie, and I will be here, too, to answer questions afterward.
Good morning, board members. I'm Katie Marjanovic. I'm with the LA County Sanitation District's Reuse and Compliance Section. As Robert mentioned, I'll provide a little bit more information on the background of our temperature study and an overview of some of the study results. Okay, so the sanitation districts operate 5 water reclamation plants in the Lower San Gabriel River watershed, which is shown on this map. Altogether, there are 11 discharge points that are located along the San Gabriel River, the Rio Hondo, San Jose Creek, and Coyote Creek. 3 of those discharge points also convey advanced treated wastewater from the Water Replenishment District ARC facility. It is important to note that this is a highly engineered system. It includes both fully lined concrete channels as well as unlined streams. The flows are managed for flood control. There are several major dams in the watershed, as well as for groundwater recharge. In fact, many of our discharge points are only used intermittently, and very frequently the river flows upstream of those discharge points are dry. So in 2021, the Regional Board reduced temperature limits in the district's MPDS permits. A key change in the new permit is that ambient temperatures are no longer considered when evaluating exceedances. Our WRPs cannot meet the new temperature limits year-round. Effluent temperatures typically exceed 80 degrees during the summer, which you can see in these data from our Los Coyotes WRP. We requested a compliance schedule from the regional board and time within the schedule to conduct studies to address the question of whether the WRP discharges are adversely affecting the warm freshwater habitat beneficial use. We developed a study work plan that was done in coordination with SQRP, as well as a technical advisory committee, as Robert mentioned. The TAC included regulatory staff from the Water Board, Regional Board, the State Water Board, EPA, also staff from the resource agencies, California Department of Fish and Wildlife, U.S. Fish and Wildlife, NOAA. We conducted the studies over about 2 years and then have drafted the findings into a technical study report. And those materials are all available on SQRP's website. So to do the temperature study, we brought together a pretty comprehensive consulting team. We had fish biologists, field biologists, aquatic toxicologists, wastewater process engineers, others. We looked at different parts of the study that Robert went through. The study included biological evaluations, so we assessed the biological condition of the receiving waters to see if there were differences upstream and downstream of our WRPs. We looked at the invertebrate communities. We did benthic macroinvertebrate algae surveys. We also analyzed historical data. We looked at the fish communities, the vertebrates. We did eDNA analysis and fish collection and visual observations at a number of sites across the study area. We also did a lot of temperature monitoring. We deployed sensors at many sites throughout the watershed. We took discrete temperature readings on a weekly or monthly basis throughout the study period. More recently, we employed a temperature model to look at how river temperatures change downstream of our discharge points. We looked at sources of temperature to our treatment plants. We installed sensors at all of our WRPs, both in influent, effluent, as well as after each of the major treatment process steps. We looked at temperatures of industrial waste discharges to our collection system, as well as temperatures in the potable water supply within the service area of our WRPs to see whether seasonality that we were seeing in wastewater temperatures tracked any seasonality in the potable water supply. And lastly, we did evaluate different temperature control options. We looked at chillers, cooling towers, as well as some nature-based and other alternative strategies. So now I'll give an overview of some of the findings from each of these parts of the study. So when we looked at the benthic macroinvertebrate, the algae data, we looked at different metrics, including taxa counts, richness, prevalence of pollutant-tolerant taxa. We also calculated the biological condition scores at each of the monitoring locations. And when we looked upstream and downstream of our discharge points, we did not see a significant difference in any of the metrics that were evaluated. For example, these plots show the calculated BMI scores upstream and downstream of three of our WRPs. So these are three different receiving waters. We don't see a significant change in the scores downstream. And that was true for all of the metrics that were evaluated, including for longer time periods. So the data really show that there was no significant difference in the BMI and the algal communities from the WRPs, and therefore no degradation in the invertebrate communities attributable to the effluent. And when we looked at the fish results, the findings were the same. The fish communities upstream and downstream of the WRPs were highly similar, and that was true across the different monitoring approaches that we used. So the eDNA results were generally consistent with the fish that were captured, which was consistent with visual observations made through the study period. In total, there were 10 types of fish identified in the study area. 8 of those 10 were found in the juvenile life stage, suggesting that the fish are able to reproduce in the study area and complete their life cycle. All fish were non-native. All fish found during the study were non-native. And that's consistent with the historical information that the native fish species have unfortunately been extirpated from the lower watershed, and that this occurred in the 1930s, 1950s, during construction of the dams and the channelization of the river for flood control. When we looked at sources of temperature to our wastewater, we found that the WRP treatment processes do not add a significant amount of heat to wastewater. Generally, our effluent temperatures track our influent temperatures very closely. There is about a 1 to 3 degree increase between influent and effluent temperatures. Most of that increase happens during the secondary aeration treatment process. We also found that industrial waste discharges did not significantly increase wastewater temperatures. Although some discharges can have elevated temperatures, typically the flows are quite low relative to our total influent flows. But we are keeping an eye on temperatures of industrial discharges. However, when we looked at the potable water supply temperatures, what we saw was a really strong seasonal change. And summer temperatures that go up and exceed 80 degrees in many of the distribution systems, which suggests that the potable water supply is a source of temperature to our wastewater treatment plants. In fact, across all of the temperature data sets that we looked at, we see this seasonality in temperatures that track the seasonality in ambient air temperatures, suggesting that it's really ambient conditions, ambient air temperatures that are driving our wastewater temperatures. And when we look at the longer-term data, we see these same seasonal trends. So this is these are effluent data from our Los Coyotes WRP. We see the seasonality year after year for at least the last 25 years, which tracks local ambient air temperatures. And in some cases, we are seeing long-term increases in wastewater temperatures at many of our plants as well. For instance, here we're seeing about a degree Fahrenheit increase per decade. It's not something that we've looked into in a lot of detail, but something we are noticing in our many of our data sets, suggesting, again, that it's ambient conditions, long-term climate trends that are driving wastewater temperatures. We also see this seasonality in river temperatures. So these are river temperature monitoring data from the four receiving waters to which we discharge. These are four different colors for different locations. These locations are all upstream of our WRPs. So you can see the seasonal trend. There are data gaps, but you can see the seasonality. And at all four locations, we see upstream river temperatures that exceed 80 degrees during the summer. The other trend that we see in the river temperature data are the really strong or significant diurnal changes in temperature. So it's the shift over a 24-hour period. And we see this in all of our receiving waters, despite the condition. For instance, these are temperature data from San Jose Creek. This is upstream of our San Jose Creek WRP. So this is an unlined stream area. There's more riparian vegetation, a bit more shading. We still see diurnal fluctuations over 15 degrees in the channel. And those fluctuations are tracking the air temperatures, the local air temperatures, closely. We see the same thing in the concrete line channels. These are data from Coyote Creek, upstream of our Long Beach WRP. Here, the diurnal fluctuations are even more pronounced. We're seeing 20-degree plus shifts over the course of the day. It's also tracking ambient air temperatures. You'll notice here that the water temperatures are actually much higher than the local ambient air temperatures, suggesting the concrete is playing a role in controlling the water temperatures. And in fact, when we look across all of our discharge points, where we do have flow upstream, we now have monitoring data to show that the natural river temperatures fluctuate much more than 5 degrees within relatively short periods of time. For other discharge points, we either don't have flow upstream under normal conditions, or the discharge is the start of the river in the case of the Pomona WRP. So these data really draw into question the applicability and the relevance of the Delta 5 limit for this system. We've also been modeling river temperatures. We've been working with Larry Walker Associates to use the Qual2K EPA model to look at how river temperatures change downstream of discharge points if the discharges are cooled to 80 degrees, and how those river temperatures would change, or how they compare to baseline conditions with uncooled discharges. This is a work in progress. We're still working on the modeling effort, but the preliminary results we've seen show that even if you cool the discharges, the river temperatures will very quickly rise above 80 downstream and equilibrate with ambient conditions. And we see this both in the concrete-lined channels as well as the unlined stream. These are data downstream, model data downstream of our Pomona WRP, which show that even if you cool the Pomona discharge, the river temperatures will rise above 90 within about a quarter mile downstream. They will stay above 90 for the majority of the stream length. And then when we look further downstream in the unlined sections where the Pomona flows meet discharge from our San Jose Creek WRP, the model results show even still, if you cool the San Jose Creek WRP discharge, river temperatures stay above 80 degrees and start to converge with the existing or the baseline conditions, showing really that it's ambient temperatures that are driving river temperatures despite any cooling. And we think this is pretty consistent with model results that you saw last month with the LA River, and also consistent with modeling that we have done for the Santa Clara River, which I think you'll hear about later this year. We've looked at different temperature management options. We have looked at some nature-based options. We looked at whether, for instance, we could blend the discharges with extracted groundwater to cool them. We've looked at passive cooling ponds, whether you could use spray ponds to reduce the temperature of discharges. We also looked at whether there were things we could do at the plants to help reduce temperatures, whether you could shade treatment tanks or cool the process air. What we found was that none of these options were able to reduce temperatures enough to bring the WRPs into compliance with the temperature limit. At most, they were estimated to reduce temperatures by a few degrees, 1 to 4 degrees. In the case of the implant process changes, they were not estimated to reduce temperatures at all by any measurable amount. They also had significant constraints, implementation concerns. For instance, for pond storage, we would need many hundreds of acres of space for ponds at typical flow rates and retention times, pond retention times. At typical groundwater temperatures of around 70 degrees, we would need many millions of gallons per day to blend with our discharges to cool them. And then the implant process changes. We did a small pilot study at our Valencia WRP with shaded a treatment tank that did not reduce temperatures at all. And we did some calculations with a consultant to look at whether cooling process air would reduce temperatures, and it was shown not to. So these were all deemed infeasible according to our screening matrix. The only option that was found to bring the WRPs into compliance with the permit limits year-round is mechanical chillers. We did estimate costs and energy requirements for systems at each of the five WRPs. As you can see, the costs are in the hundreds of millions of dollars per system. The total energy requirement would be about 54 million kilowatt hours per year, which would be about a 70% increase from our 2024 energy usage. And that would be associated with about 11,800 metric tons of CO2. And then these would need to be water-cooled chillers, so they would have potable water requirements as well. So you can see, very expensive, extremely energy-intensive. So to summarize our study findings, in terms of the biology, there was abundant aquatic life found throughout the study area. The fish, the BMI, the algae communities are very highly similar upstream and downstream of our WRPs, and that the current habitat conditions, which are unrelated to our discharge, will not support the native fish. The temperature monitoring and modeling show that ambient conditions are significantly influencing wastewater and river temperatures. We see these high diurnal fluctuations in the river, which draw into question the relevance of the Delta 5 limit. And modeling shows that even if the discharges are cooled to 80, the downstream river temperatures will still exceed 80, the water quality objective. Mechanical chillers are the only option that would bring the WRPs into compliance year-round. However, they are very energy intensive and do require potable water. So in all, the study findings indicate that warm beneficial uses are currently supported within the study area, and that additional temperature control measures, including new infrastructure, are not warranted. We look forward to collaborating with Regional Board staff to implement a regulatory approach. We definitely appreciate all of the time staff have spent with us so far reviewing the study findings. We urge that any new or modified permit limits should account for ambient conditions, which the studies show drive wastewater and river temperatures in the watershed, and that the Delta 5 limit should not be applied for these receiving waters. In the meantime, we will continue, as Robert mentioned, to monitor river and wastewater temperatures, conduct bioassessments in accordance with our MPDS permits to ensure that the discharges remain protective of warm beneficial use. And that's the end of our presentation. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you very much. I have one card on this item. So I think we'll hear from Mr. Tahir on this for 3 minutes, and then we can go to board questions. Thanks very much. Hear from him then.
Next slide, please. Here's the 303D fact sheet for the Burbank treatment facility, which delists temperature. You can see that it clearly says do not list, in terms of the temperature, do not list on the 303D list. At the bottom, it says that the bottom right, it says that after review of the regional board's decision, the state board staff recommends decision approval by the state board. Next slide, please. Here's the 303 fact sheet for Coyote Creek. Same thing. Do not list on the 303D list TMDL. And again, at the bottom, it says that the state board approves of the regional board's decision for the D list. Next slide, please. Temperature TMDLs in the Burbank Western Channel and San Gabriel River, Coyote Creek. And because the BWC and San Gabriel River, Coyote Creek temperature TMDLs are not on the 2024 TMDL 303D list, they cannot be subject to compliance requirements. Note the following excerpt from both permits. This order may be reopened and modified to revise effluent limitations as a result of the delisting of a pollutant from the 303D list. To spare Burbank and other permittees whose temperature TMDL was delisted, their permits should be reopened and compliance should be eliminated, although the outfall monitoring should continue. This would be a welcome relief for Burbank, who estimates over $1 million would be needed to spend on installing a chiller to cool down the effluent to meet the 86-degree water quality objective. And speaking of that, I understand that the water quality objective has been reinterpreted to be at 80 degrees Fahrenheit as opposed to 86 degrees Fahrenheit. Correct me if I'm wrong, but don't you need to do a basin plan amendment to redo the water quality objective for these particular permittees? I don't know. I maybe I'm wrong. I mean, was this done before? Was there a water quality objective reopener or whatever you'd like to call it that adjusts the temperature from 86 to 80 degrees? Because if you haven't done it, you should really do it. Otherwise, you can't enforce it. Anyway, thank you.
Okay. Does staff have any? Oh, we have another one. Well, this is on item 11. Does staff have any response to the? And then we'll go to board questions.
No, but we're available if you have any questions for us.
Okay. Thank you. So, any questions from board members for LA County Sanitation Districts? Who would like to start?
Go ahead. Yes, thank you. Thank you both for a really informative presentation, and I really appreciate the nod to climate change and planning for it and prioritizing it in your works. We obviously did hear a lot of the same data for the LA River in our last meeting. And my comments are going to be much the same as they were to some of those aspects. The underlying message that I think we're getting is that ambient temperature is kind of the monolith here and is what is keeping our rivers at temperatures that are not conducive to native species, right? And that's true. I believe that. I know that. I think my issue with this is that we're talking about current, very impaired conditions, and there's a whole movement out there trying to improve those conditions, right? And I know from my river advocacy days that deconcretizing some of these channels seems an impossibility, but we are living in the era of dams coming down, of rivers being renaturalized, of floodplain buyback programs, of what the late Melanie Winter used to call urban acupuncture. Cities across the world are breaking up their concrete. And so as we look at these temperature studies, yes, for the rivers and for effluent, which is the jurisdiction of this board, I see a huge opportunity to look beyond the rivers. Like, if ambient temperature is the problem here, then how do we change ambient temperature? And if can we go back to the map that she put up at one point? If you look at the map of where these, I'll wait for it. Do we have it? Great, thank you. Okay, so if we look at this map, the areas that we're talking about, I think it was before this, really closely align with the 2018 study by Tree People that looked at ambient air temperatures across the county and how it lines up with tree canopy across the county. And it was sort of this big unveiling of our tree canopy is not equitably spread across our county. And truly, some of these communities that these rivers wind through are disadvantaged communities, you know, and do not have tree cover. And they are highly urbanized. And so what is it that the county might be able to do in partnership with others, other agencies, but also organizations like Tree People, like Climate Resolve, like ARLA, to break up some of the concrete in the surrounding area and add some of the tree canopy that our populations need? I mean, you may be able to save lives and bring back fish in one fell swoop.
No, I think you're expressing a wonderful vision for the river, whether it's the LA or the San Gabriel River. We are a special district. We're somewhat limited compared to municipalities and counties. But nevertheless, we do work with other stakeholders. We're on the Council for Watershed Health. I'm a board member there, working on getting out into the local communities, whether and the native tribes as well, communicating on the importance of water and working on smaller projects that can be done. We have worked with the Safe Clean Water project, not only from the, you know, stormwater diversion, but of course a big side benefit of those projects are the greening, whether it be of schools or other redoing parks, of course with trees and other things. And also one of the big things that we're a part of is the Habitat Authority that manages the Puente Hills, the 4,000 acres there, and making sure that those stay as an open preserve, as lungs for the city, so to speak, with respect to that. But what you're really describing is a watershed approach, and that is exactly what's needed. I think, you know, I am very pleased, and I think the chair has seen this over the last few years, that among wastewater and water agencies, there's more collaboration with respect to these pure water projects. But we need collaboration with other stakeholders. We need, you know, the flood control, the municipalities that want to do projects, even the industrial facilities that are, many of them are sited, unfortunately, right next to the river, you know, and have a lot of concrete and other things. And when there's stormwater runoff, of course, that's a big issue. So I think the important thing is that we continue to move forward with that and protecting what we have and improving what we have. And that's why I talked about those biological assessments are important, removing Arundo, you know, and improving the habitat for the species that we can benefit now, and making sure our temperatures don't get hotter. But, of course, I mean, climate change is the driver. There are local things we can do, but continuing to fight climate change as well. But, I mean, that is the vision, I think, ultimately, as we move forward, and all the projects we do have to be viewed with that watershed lens.
I appreciate that. And so my next question is to the staff. What can we do in these processes to support that kind of watershed approach and collaboration across different stakeholders?
Well, we can look into creative opportunities using our authority to leverage the permit requirements to encourage that type of watershed approach. And that's something that we can work with the County Sanitation District in the months moving forward. I'm hesitant to think of the specific things right here off the top of my head, but we have been thinking about those things over the past couple months, and we certainly can do all we can with our authority and leverage all the permit requirements we can to incentivize projects to restore the watershed as a whole, like you were proposing.
One of the key things was attending our Earth Day and communicating to people about potentially safe products in their home, mm-hmm. PFAS-free products. Also communicating the fact that these are our storm channels, too. So with respect to trash and other debris mm-hmm. in Carson, of course, the Dominguez Channel has been an issue, and educating the public on protecting that channel. You protect yourself, you also protect the water system. So I think that is a must and a baseline that we have to do as we move forward.
Absolutely agree. And yes, I would be really supportive of seeing kind of a leveraged, holistic approach. So thank you both. That's it for me.
Yes, thank you very much for this informative presentation. And so it's really heartening to hear that you are looking at a watershed approach and going beyond the confines of the special district, because we just need to be able to do that. But based on the presentation, it really does sound like that the extirpation of species is really a direct result of the gray infrastructure and the channelization that has been put in for the purposes of flood control in many ways, and not a direct result of temperature going up and down. And so we're kind of like, attacking the wrong, variable in trying to solve this problem at this point. But one suggestion I would have, I know that you're reaching out to other agencies, but it'd be good at this point in time, as this is draft information, is to reach out to LA County Flood Control District to really help them to understand your dilemma and help them understand what was the past results of the development and construction of the flood control channels, and if there is any way at this point in time that modifications or opportunities for nature-based solutions in a large way can be done, because it's not up to you as a special district to be able to, it's outside your purview, but certainly LA County Flood Control could potentially do that, but still they have the primary responsibility of protecting the public as well. So that has to be balanced very, very carefully.
That is a great comment. And with regard to the San Gabriel, we talked about the lower reach. The upper reach is in the mountains and has three dams that are controlled by the county. They've increased the capacity of those dams recently. You're probably aware of removing debris from those dams. So they use those, of course, to deliver water at different times to spreading basins and to other users. So I think there needs to be additional discussion with respect to can they optimize that not only for distribution purposes but also for habitat purposes as well. So that is something we'll look into.
Yeah, that'll be great, actually, to have that discussion. And then another thing I did want to point out as well is basically, taking a watershed-wide approach is going to be necessary to make this change. But then again, looking at achieving conditions of the past is not going to be, I think, in my opinion, very fruitful looking forward with all of the changes that we had just talked about today in terms of climate. And so it might be good to get a group together to look at what can be in the future. What type of habitat would be more suitable for the climate that we're going to be experiencing in the near future, and how, what can we do to encourage that at this point in time, rather than trying to recreate the past. Thank you.
Yes, thank you so much. I really appreciate it. And as my other board members mentioned, the attention to issues of climate change and community concerns. And we see this ambient air temperature and outside of just our inland rivers and streams, but also in globally in our oceans.
Oh, yeah.
And that's happening because of climate change. So thank you for that. But my question is for staff, similar to Board Member Christensen's approach of how we can take a holistic methodology to this. And it's been mentioned that, yes, tree planting and tree shading only reduces from 1 to 4 degrees. To me, 4 degrees is a lot. But when you're looking at summer temperatures where they it can be from 5 to 20 degrees, I understand that may seem not as significant. But in the long term, having tree plantings and shade provides multiple cool benefits. So if we can look into proposals, methodologies possibly, where we can phase in these requirements, give maybe a longer term for compliance for those that are doing nature-based solutions, even though it might not get them to that 80-degree requirement year-round, but we understand they're doing other best management practices that have co-benefits and contribute to the larger ecological life of the rivers and of course, aquatic life, which we're most concerned with this regulation. So that would be something I would really be interested in, again, providing these incentives that are staged and drawing out compliance if they're doing these best management practices like tree shadings that have significant co-benefits besides just reducing the temperature. Thank you.
No questions, but just wanted to thank you both for the presentation,
thank
and
you.
I echo the sentiments of my colleagues and look forward to working with staff on this. Thank you.
All right, well, let me also thank you for your presentation here, Ms. Thank you very much. I understand, yes, a watershed approach. We have to go there. Battling climate change, want to commend you on everything that you're doing there, want to also applaud the work that LA County Sanitation is doing with MWD with respect to pure water SoCal and moving forward on that. Such important work. But regarding this, though, I mean, we have to have a permit and we have to have a number.
Yes.
Right. And basically, I think what you're telling us today is that 80 is not the right number because of the tremendous cost that would have to be incurred in order to comply with that requirement. What I'm not hearing, though, is what is the right number, and is there a difference in that number between summer and winter? So, and I also understand that we're looking at this kind of midstream here because this is an obligation to report to us, which we appreciate, but this is an ongoing conversation that you're having with staff. But from your point of view, then we cannot not have a temperature limit in the permit.
No, temperature, yes. I mean, if we discharged at 100 degrees, imagine the harm. So we do need a permit limit. So we are midstream, and this is why I think Katie mentioned at the end, we appreciate the collaboration with the regional board staff, that I think we've already talked about some different ideas of looking at averaging periods to account for that. Allowing for, you know, ambient conditions, you know, that, hey, if there is a 100-degree day on, you know, that really limits, you know, is going to be a driving force. So there are different ideas with respect to what we can do in the permit. I think the two big things that we would hope would be included is an allowance that, hey, if the ambient conditions are such that there's a provision that there's some type of exemption during that period. And then also the Delta 5, as Katie mentioned, for the type of watershed that we have, it doesn't make sense. If this was back east where the water temperature were 35 and you were discharging 80 degree temperature, I think the Delta 5 is very important, but not here. I think those are the two big things. But I think there are opportunities for looking at an averaging period, but also coupled with continued monitoring. We still have to look at our industrial sources. We still have to look at our treatment plant sources to make sure that we're not, you know, backsliding with respect to temperature. But I think there are different ideas, and we would need, now that we have all this data, we can really talk about what's most appropriate. Is there a summer number that should be in there with, you know, a provision for ambient conditions? Yes.
All right.
So I'm not prepared today to have that number, but I think that would be the collaboration with staff to
get there. No, I understand, and I wasn't trying to push you to put a number on the record today. Yeah. And I know that there are ongoing conversations. Yeah. Thank you very much.
Thank you
for coming.
Thank you
for your presentation. Truly appreciate it. Thanks. Okay. There is no vote to be taken on that. Okay, thank you. Just want to clarify. So our next item is item number 11. I suggest that we take a 10-minute break and then come back and deal with item number 11. Should we do that? Okay. Okay, well, it is now.
No, excuse me,
Well,
Chair.
Actually.
I would like to recommend if we take an early lunch and go into closed session, and then we can do the enforcement item.
Oh, so you would like to do that now?
After our closed session and lunch.
Okay. But you want to take closed session at this point?
Yes.
Okay. All right. So that's what we'll do. We'll adjourn into closed session, then we'll come back for item 11.
Oh, and just for the record.
Go ahead.
We're going to closed session to discuss item 12L, subrobinette II, a matter which, based on existing facts and circumstances, the Los Angeles Water Board is deciding whether to initiate litigation.
We're going to resume, and we will now go to item number 11. So item number 11 is the consideration of a proposed settlement of Administrative Civil Liability Complaint Number R4-2025-0268 concerning the Boeing Company in the matter of 39 alleged effluent limit violations of the Boeing Company's National Pollutant Discharge Elimination System permit for the Santa Susana Field Laboratory from January 2023 to March 2025. And I have to read some things regarding this item. So item number 11 is the consideration, as I've said, of a proposed settlement of administrative civil liability. Due to the extensive public comment from interested payment received during the public review period of the proposed settlement, the executive officer, in consultation with me, determined that it is appropriate to bring this matter before the board for its consideration. The proposed settlement before the board would resolve these alleged violations without an evidentiary hearing. The board may approve the proposed settlement as presented or decline to adopt the settlement. If the board declines to approve the proposed settlement, it may provide direction to the parties. The parties to this proceeding are as follows. First, the prosecution team, which consists of staff from the Los Angeles Water Board and the Office of Enforcement. Secondly, the Boeing Company. The board may also receive advice from the advisory team, which consists of the executive officer Susana Arredondo, assistant executive officer Jenny Newman, supervising water resource control engineer Jung-hee Lim, and board counsel Adriano Nunez. The order of today's proceeding will be as follows. First, board counsel will provide additional direction about the nature of the proceeding. Then we will proceed to hear presentations from the parties. The parties have been granted up to 20 minutes The prosecution team will go first. The prosecution team's presentation will include an overview of the violation, terms of the settlement, and how the proposed resolution is consistent with applicable enforcement policies and regulatory requirements. The prosecution team will be followed by Ms. Katie Moxley, who is the Director of Remediation and Environmental Policy at the Boeing Company, who will also provide a presentation to the board in support of the proposed settlement. Once the presentations by the parties are concluded, we will hear comments from interested persons. Comments are limited to 3 minutes each, unless additional time has been granted by the board chair. Once all comments have been heard, the board will deliberate on whether to approve or reject the proposed settlement. If the board does not take final action on the proposed settlement, the board may continue this proceeding to the next board meeting. All right, and the board may ask questions of the parties at any time during the proceeding. However, I will ask board members to keep their questions until we are, until the presentations are done. And I'll now ask Ms. Nunez for any additional remarks.
Is this on? And just to reiterate, today the board is not considering evidence in support of an administrative liability complaint or finding liability for violations of permits. Therefore, as Board Chair Nahai already stated, the board's options are either to approve the settlement agreement or to reject this particular settlement agreement. The board members may explain the basis for the decision based on the information presented today, the comments, and the written response to comments. The board may not go into closed session to discuss their decision, but rather must ask any questions and hold their discussion on the record in open session.
Thank you. So let us start with the prosecution presentation, and I will ask Mr. Russ Colby to provide introductory remarks. He will then turn it over to Ching To, Senior Water Resource Control Engineer, for additional remarks. Following that, we will hear from Kaylin Ellison and Noah Bennett, attorneys with State Board's Office of Enforcement. So 20 minutes each for the prosecution team.
Thank you. I'll wait for the presentation. All right, perfect. Good afternoon, Chair Nahai and members of the board. Again, for the record, my name is Russ Colby. I serve as the Assistant Executive Officer on the Groundwater Division at the Los Angeles Board, as well as the Chief Prosecutor for this matter. I'm here to introduce our proposed settlement of administrative civil liability complaint number R4-2025-0268 in the amount of $595,026 against the Boeing Company for effluent limit violations of their National Pollutant Discharge Elimination System, or NPDS, permit at the Santa Susana Field Laboratory, or SSFL, from January of 2023 to March of 2025. With us today from the prosecution team are State Water Board Office of Enforcement attorneys Kaylin Ellison and Noah Bennett, Office of Enforcement staff Aaron Garner, and Regional Board Enforcement 1 Unit staff Ching To and Bobby Torres. I will now turn the presentation over to Ms. To.
Good afternoon, Chair Nahai. My name is Ching To. I'm the Unit Supervisor of the Los Angeles Water Board Enforcement 1 Unit and part of the prosecution team for this matter. As Mr. Colby stated earlier, we are here today to present a proposed settlement for your considerations. This is not an evidentiary hearing where the board hears arguments from the parties, weighs the evidence, and determines an appropriate penalty amount. Instead, the question in front of the board today is whether to approve or reject the proposed settlement. To assist the board in this process, we will discuss in the presentation the background of the case, the alleged violations, the penalty proposed, comments received, the prosecution team's responses to comments, and our recommendation. The SSFL is situated at the top of the Simi Hills on the border of the Los Angeles and Ventura counties. It occupies approximately 2,850 acres. Boeing is an owner and operator of a portion of the SSFL. All industrial activities at the site ceased in 2006. Due to historical activities, there is extensive soil and groundwater contaminations. Current activities on site are solely related to site decommissioning, decontamination, and environmental remediation and restoration. From January 2023 to March 2025, when the alleged violation occurred, SSFL discharges stormwater runoff to Bell Creek and Arroyo Simi, which are waters of the state, through various discharge points under waste discharge requirement and NPDES permits order numbers R4-2015-0033, which will be referred to as the 2015 permit, and R4-2023-0359, which will be referred to as the 2023 permit. Discharge points relevant to the violations alleged in this matter are highlighted in the site map shown and includes discharge points 001, 002, 011, which discharged to Bell Creek, and discharge point 004, 006, 009, and 010, which discharged to the Arroyo Simi. The proposed settlement will resolve 39 effluent limit violations of the 2015 and 2023 permits from January 2023 through March 2025. The alleged violations are based on data submitted by Boeing in quarterly self-monitoring reports under the NPDES permits. For violations 1 through 35, the prosecution team alleges Boeing violated the maximum daily effluent limits for TCDD equivalents, lead, mercury, manganese, and sulfate, as well as the instantaneous maximum effluent limit for pH in the 2015 permit or 2023 permit on 35 instances during the violation period. The prosecution team opted to pursue discretionary administrative civil liability for these violations. The proposed settlement imposes an administrative civil liability of $583,026 for violations 1 through 35. For violations 36 to 39, the prosecution team alleges Boeing violated the maximum daily effluent limits for iron at discharge point 011 in the 2015 permit on 4 instances. The prosecution team opted to pursue mandatory minimum penalties, or MMPs, of $3,000 for each of these violations. The 2023 permit does not contain effluent limits for iron at discharge point 011 based on new information that iron concentrations are likely from soils that are naturally occurring and not related to past industrial activity that occurred at the site. The proposed settlement imposes MMP of $12,000 for violations 36 through 39. The prosecution team pursued discretionary penalties for violations 1 through 35. As the MMP amount of $102,000 would not be appropriate given the history of violations at the site. The prosecution team used penalty calculation methodology in the State Water Board's Water Quality Enforcement Policy to develop a proposed penalty for violations 1 through 35. However, this resulted in a penalty of almost $20 million for 35 effluent limit violations. While an escalation of penalties is appropriate given the history of the site, imposing a $20 million penalty is not. Therefore, the prosecution team turned to the enforcement policy's Step 7, titled Other Factors as Justice May Require, which allows for adjustment to the combined total base liability amount if the amount is deemed inappropriate and express findings are made to justify the adjustment. The prosecution team also turned to guidance from the previous consent judgment to determine an appropriate penalty. The stipulated penalty for violations 1 to 35 would have been $281,250 if assessed under the consent judgment. The prosecution team believes this amount would be too low since effluent limit violations have persisted at SFFL for years. Instead, the prosecution team doubled the consent judgment amounts as an escalation from past penalty amounts. The prosecution team also added the cost of investigation and enforcement for a total of $583,026 for violations 1 to 35. Together with the MMPs for violations 36 to 39, the final proposed penalty included in the proposed settlement is $595,026. This amount is more than five times the MMP amount. Now I return this presentation over to Office of Enforcement Attorney Kaylin Ellison.
Good afternoon, members of the board. My name is Kaylin Ellison, and I'm attorney representing the prosecution team in this matter from the Office of Enforcement. So I'm going to start out by discussing the procedural history of the case, the public comments received, and the prosecution team's response to comments. The administrative civil liability complaint was issued on December 1st, 2025. On December 10th, Boeing signed a waiver form that waived its right to a hearing and agreed to pay the amount proposed in the complaint. The settlement was transmitted to potentially interested persons and posted for a 30-day public comment period that ended on January 15th, 2026. We received four written comments from Los Angeles Waterkeeper, Heal the Bay, the Wishtoyo Kumash Foundation, and Christina Walsh. The board should be aware that Los Angeles Waterkeeper recently filed a Clean Water Act citizen suit against Boeing that includes the same violation alleged in this proposed settlement. The prosecution team believes that Waterkeeper's comments, especially those related to the penalty amount, should be viewed considering their citizen suit and financial incentive. The parties separately prepared written responses to comments. In the interest of time, we are going to focus on some of the main comments related to the reduced liability amount, deterrence, economic benefit, a change to the payment information, supplemental environmental projects, or SEPs, and topics that were outside the scope of this enforcement action. And I'll note that the comments seem to focus on the discretionary violations, which are violations 1 through 35, and not the MMPs, which are violations 36 through 39. Some of the commenters believe the penalty amount is too low and is inconsistent with the enforcement policy. The prosecution team disagrees. We allege the violations in such a way as to make it as transparent as possible, allow the board maximum flexibility should the case not settle and proceed to a contested evidentiary hearing, and result in a reasonable proposed penalty amount. The reduction is consistent with the enforcement policy. Step 7 of the penalty methodology, known as other factors as justice may require, is very broad and allows adjustments to the combined total base liability amount if express findings are made and there's a determination that the amount is inappropriate. A thorough and transparent explanation of the reduction is included in Attachment A to the complaint. And as mentioned earlier, the prosecution team made the express findings and determined that the combined total base liability amount would result in an inappropriately high ACL for the type of violations. We would like to note, and think it is important to note, that we are aware of only one other instance in this region over the past 5 years where discretionary enforcement has been selected for violations subject to MMPs. Discretionary enforcement was appropriate here because of the history of violations, and while an escalation of penalties is appropriate, we firmly believe a $20 million penalty calculated in the first few steps of the enforcement policy is not, especially when you consider that most other dischargers would only receive the $3,000 MMPs. And as Jean mentioned, the penalty we are proposing is over five times that MMP amount. We received comments claiming the proposed settlement was insufficient to deter Boeing from future violations of the permit, and that contains no meaningful analysis of the deterrent effect. Again, we disagree. The proposed settlement achieves and balances all goals of the enforcement policy, which includes, but is not limited to, deterring harmful conduct and protecting the public. There is a general deterrent to the regulated community by sending the message that a repeat history of effluent limit violations may result in discretionary enforcement. The penalty amount in and of itself should not be the sole basis in determining whether or not there is deterrence. There is a specific deterrent to Boeing in this case. Even a $20 million in penalty likely would not have a meaningful financial deterrent to Boeing or impact, since they are a multi-billion-dollar company. But from a public relations standpoint, this impact is important and affects their reputation and perception within the community, thereby providing a specific deterrent to Boeing. Waterkeeper also had several comments claiming that the economic benefit analysis arrived at an incorrect conclusion and insinuating it could be tens of millions of dollars. Staff from the State Water Board's Office of Enforcement Special Investigations Unit completed the economic benefit analysis for this case. Staff have extensive experience with economic benefit and using the BEN model and followed the steps in the enforcement policy for their analysis. Prosecution team provide a thorough explanation of the analysis in the response to comments, specifically a response to comments 1.15 through 1.32. We do not see a scenario where economic benefit could be tens of million dollars. With all respect to Waterkeeper's expert, does not appear he has experience performing economic benefit analyses as defined in the enforcement policy, which follows a very specific procedure. Nor did we find evidence that he had experience using the BEN model. We also think that his analysis did not consider key components of the economic benefit analysis, such as looking at least costly compliance action alternatives, and was made without seeing the prosecution team's analysis and assumptions. We have Aaron Gardner here today, who is the supervisor of the Office of Enforcement Special Investigations Unit, if you have any questions on the economic benefit analysis. And one of Waterkeeper's comments did lead us to realize that there is a minor procedural oversight in the amended waiver form. Payment for violations 1 through 35 of $583,026 should be made to the Waste Discharge Permit Fund, not the cleanup and abatement account, where the remaining $12,000 for the MMPs and violations 36 through 39 should still be made to the cleanup and abatement account. We communicated this issue to Boeing, and they confirmed that change is acceptable. And I'll now turn the presentation over to Noah Bennett.
Good afternoon, members of the board. My name is Noah Bennett, and like Ms. Ellison, I'm an attorney with the Office of Enforcement representing the prosecution team. We received comments suggesting that the settlement should include environmentally beneficial projects that benefit the local community or watershed. We refer to these projects as SEPs. Neither the prosecution team nor the board have the ability to force a discharger to include a SEP in a settlement. When the prosecution team issued the ACL complaint, we included a waiver form that contained the standard options for waiver of a right to a hearing. Boeing chose to waive its right to a hearing and settle the case by paying the proposed penalty amount in full. Boeing reaffirmed this decision in their response to comments, stating that no environmentally beneficial projects were required. As a procedural matter, the SEP policy and the Public Resources Code state that SEPs can only be agreed upon as part of a settlement. So if this case were to proceed to a contested evidentiary hearing before the board, a SEP could not be included in a final order. In this case, the prosecution team also believes that a direct and upfront payment will have a more punitive impact. Next slide. We also received comments related to matters outside the scope of this enforcement action. The proposed settlement specifically and exclusively addresses the effluent limit violations alleged in the complaint and its attachments. Any other potential alleged violations are outside the scope of this enforcement action and should not be considered by the board in deciding whether to adopt the proposed settlement. The prosecution team reserves the right to pursue any and all enforcement actions authorized by law for any violations not resolved by the proposed settlement. Any comments related to modifications to the 2023 permit are outside the scope of this enforcement action. The proposed settlement addresses violations of the permit as written. Similarly, any changes to cleanup and remediation activities at the site are outside the scope of this proposed settlement. It's the Department of Toxic Substances Control that is the lead agency for the cleanup of soil and groundwater at the site, not the water boards. I'll now invite Mr. Colby to share the prosecution team's recommendation.
So for the record again, Russ Colby, I want to thank you for your time and attention to this matter. The prosecution team recommends the board adopt the settlement as proposed with the modification to the payment information. And that concludes the prosecution team's presentation.
Thank you very much. Next, we will hear from Ms. Katie Moxley, who is the Director of Remediation and Environmental Policy with the Boeing Company. This is for 20 minutes.
Thank you. And I'll wait for the slides. Good afternoon. My name is Katie Moxley. I'm the Director of Remediation and Environmental Policy at the Boeing Company. In this role, I oversee Boeing's global remediation program, including the Santa Susana Field Laboratory site. I've been working as a geologist and then in subsequent leadership roles within Boeing's remediation organization for the past 20 years and recently moved into the director role early in 2025. On behalf of our team, I thank the board chair, board members, and staff for your time today and your continued leadership in protecting stormwater quality. Do I need to point this somewhere? It seems to be stuck. Could you go back two, please? There's an agenda chart. One forward. Oh, thank you. Interesting. The text isn't showing up there. So I'll just proceed. I'll go through the agenda. I appreciate the opportunity to present to the board today. We're here because despite our best efforts, we do continue to have some permit exceedances at the Santa Susana site. In this presentation, I'll provide an overview of storm water management at Santa Susana. I'll then describe why the settlement complies with both statutory requirements and water board policy. Finally, I'll explain why Boeing is willing to settle this matter, even though we disagree with some of the prosecution team's analysis. Ultimately, we do request the board's approval of the settlement. I also want to recommit that we will continue to do what we can in accordance with expert recommendations and as allowed by regulations to eliminate all stormwater permit violations at the site. I'll first begin by discussing how Boeing manages stormwater at the site. Santa Susana is an extremely large and complex site. Historical activities ceased approximately 20 years ago, and almost all buildings are demolished. The site is over 2,800 acres. The federal government owns approximately 450 acres, which is administered by NASA. As you can see from this slide, that covers all of what is designated as Area 2 and about 50 acres of Area 1, which is located in the northern portion of the site. The Department of Energy also leased approximately 90 acres of Area 4. Although the federal government owns a portion of the site and DOE and NASA's activities have resulted in contamination for which they are responsible, Boeing is currently the sole permittee on the stormwater permit. We understand our obligations under the permit, and we do strive to meet them. The fact that we continue to get some exceedances indicates that there remains room for improvement. Next slide, please.
Can you please hand the mic more towards
you? Of course. Thank you. The site topography and presence of naturally occurring and ambient levels of constituents in soil makes stormwater management challenging. As you can see from the photos on this slide, the terrain is very hilly and steep. There are two general means of controlling stormwater runoff and preventing permit violations at the site. First, we have two robust state-of-the-art treatment systems that are paired with retention ponds. Where possible, surface water is routed from historical operational areas to the ponds, so the water can then be treated in the treatment systems. Second, Boeing has installed throughout the site numerous best management practices, or BMPs, that reduce erosion or catch, impede, or filter stormwater. For example, BMPs are used in portions of the site where the topography is too steep to collect water in ponds or would require huge dams that would themselves present a risk to preservation of habitat, species, and tribal artifacts. Next slide, please. Thank you. Thank you. Is this slide six? Oh, perfect. Thank you. Boeing is committed to addressing stormwater quality and meeting permit requirements, and we have invested significant resources to do so. The company has spent over $150 million on stormwater management controls and stormwater permit compliance efforts since 2008. The number of permit exceedances has significantly reduced over time, and we've achieved 98% compliance with permit limits since 2015. We are not at 100%, and we must continue our efforts. Next slide, please. Thank you. We've established a comprehensive program and have made numerous improvements to manage stormwater at the site. For example, we use innovative and cutting-edge BMPs. Some of those BMPs have won awards, including from the California Stormwater Quality Association. We've placed hundreds of many different types of BMPs throughout the site, and I'll share some of those on the next slide. Boeing also designed and operates state-of-the-art treatment systems to manage stormwater at Santa Susana. The integrated treatment system includes conveyance, treatment, and pumping systems, which are designed to maximize surface water collection and treatment prior to discharge. We've also established a comprehensive inspection and maintenance program to ensure the treatment systems and BMPs remain in good condition and are operating appropriately. Additionally, part of our program is to evaluate the treatment and BMP performance and identify improvements. We do this by working with third parties, including consultants and the surface water expert panel. Lastly, we implement spill prevention, control, and response measures to minimize risk to surface waters. Next slide. As mentioned on the previous slide, stormwater permit compliance is a constant focus for Boeing, and we have implemented numerous stormwater controls and measures to improve stormwater quality. In addition to the two treatment systems, you can see some BMP examples listed here, including flow-through media or rock beds at 8 outfalls and other features designed to slow or filter stormwater or prevent soil erosion. Next slide. Other efforts to improve stormwater quality relate to frequent inspection and improvements at the site. For example, we perform regular road maintenance to prevent erosion. We've modified culverts and otherwise routed stormwater to filter media or treatment systems. We've also performed interim source removal actions to directly address contaminants remaining from prior industrial activities at the site. Next slide, please. Boeing spends significant amounts of money, millions of dollars per year, to maintain and operate the stormwater treatment system and BMPs, conduct permit-required surface water sampling, and implement changes as recommended by the surface water expert panel and approved by the regional board. Our efforts generally rely on an adaptive management framework in which we continually evaluate the data and then implement modifications or improvements. The surface water expert panel, which is comprised of internationally recognized experts, evaluate site data and recommends improvements. They also perform source investigations with multiple lines of evidence and recommend improvements, expansion, or modification or installation of new BMPs. Next slide. In 2007, the Water Board required the creation of an independent stormwater panel of experts. Thank you. One for, thank you. the stormwater panel of experts to review and advise Boeing on stormwater management controls at Santa Susana. This was done as a direct response to the complexities of managing stormwater at the site. The current stormwater permit requires the continued involvement of the expert panel. The panel serves at the request of the Water Board, and each expert panel member is approved by the Board. Throughout the year, the panel regularly reviews site monitoring data, evaluates performance of the BMPs, and recommends new or improved BMPs. The expert panel then issues an annual report that summarizes their findings and recommendations. The panel also performs research, modeling, and other work as requested by the Water Board and engages with the public through an annual site tour and public meeting. Over the years, the expert panel has been extremely helpful in identifying ways to improve stormwater quality at the site. Next slide, please. Boeing has implemented all of the Boeing has implemented all of the expert panel's recommendations that were feasible under Water Board and DTSC permitting or oversight. This slide shows pictures of a few types of BMPs that the expert panel recommended that Boeing has implemented. Those recommendations include fiber rolls and wattles, culvert modifications, and other efforts. I'd like to highlight in particular the B1 media bed. In its October 2025 annual report, the expert panel recommended that the B1 media bed be rebuilt. The prosecution team incorrectly suggested in its economic benefit analysis in the ACL complaint that Boeing delayed the rebuild of this feature. But that's incorrect. Boeing rebuilt the media bed as soon as possible in first quarter of this year. Next slide, please. Erosion control is also an important part of our stormwater management program. We've implemented several different types of measures to minimize erosion, two of which you can see here, hydromulch to seed and stabilize the soil and promote vegetation growth, and jute netting and fiber rolls to control erosion. Next slide, please. In addition to our focused efforts to manage stormwater in compliance with the permit, including the treatment systems and BMPs I just discussed, we're looking forward to beginning the soil cleanup in our areas of responsibility at Santa Susana. Soil cleanup is important because it will address significant materials remaining in soil from former industrial activities. DTSC released its draft remedy decision for Boeing's soil cleanup for public review and comment last September, and we anticipate the agency will issue its final decision this summer, allowing us to begin our cleanup early next year. Next slide, please. Now I'd like to talk a little bit about the proposed ACL settlement. We think that the settlement is appropriate, and we request that it be approved by the board. Next slide, please. As you just heard in the prosecution team's presentation, they prepared a detailed, transparent, and thoughtful analysis of the violations covered by the settlement. It represents forceful enforcement. However, as we indicated in our response to comments, Boeing does not agree with every aspect of the prosecution team's analysis. In particular, we believe that the prosecution team improperly inflated the base liability amount in several ways. The prosecution team overstated the actual or potential harm, used per gallon instead of per day penalties, and failed to properly consider culpability and Boeing's cooperation. For example, using per gallon penalties is not common. It's typically applied only in those situations where the permittee knowingly and willfully continued to violate the permit and did not take action or used minimal effort to improve stormwater quality and meet permit limits. And that's not the case here. As I've just described, Boeing has expanded significant effort and resources to manage stormwater at the site. We have spent over $150 million since 2008, and we continue to spend millions of dollars annually to meet stormwater permit limits. We've achieved a 98% compliance rate over the past 10 years. Despite our disagreements with these aspects of the ACL, Boeing is willing to enter into the settlement and pay the almost $600,000 penalty to resolve this matter efficiently and allow us to remain focused on measures that protect surface water quality and public health and starting the cleanup at our site. Next slide, please. We believe the settlement is appropriate. Both statute and state board policy require downward adjustments when the base penalty is inappropriately high. The prosecution team found that the base amount was inappropriately high both for the type of violations alleged and because of the high daily discharge volume and the multiple days of violations. For those reasons, the prosecution team adjusted the penalty amount. The adjustment was made based on an assessment for similar conduct made in the recent past, and doing so follows both statutory and state board policy requirements. The alleged violations in this case are similar to those alleged against Boeing in prior enforcement action concerning effluent limit violations under the stormwater permit. The prior enforcement action resulted in a consent judgment, which included stipulated penalties for any future permit violations. The consent judgment was in effect as recently as 2022. When the court approved the consent judgment and evaluated the same statutory factors in the enforcement policy. As a result, adjusting the inappropriately high base penalty by comparing it to the recent consent judgment follows state board's enforcement policy. Next slide, please. Boeing wishes to focus its efforts on stormwater permit compliance and its soil and groundwater cleanup. So while we do not agree with all of the prosecution team's analysis, we are willing to settle this matter. The penalties here are much more stringent and punitive than was imposed for prior violations, and it sends a strong message regarding how the board will address future noncompliance. The settlement also reaffirms Boeing's commitment to focus its efforts on meeting permit requirements and continuously reviewing and improving our systems. For these reasons, Boeing respectfully requests that the regional board approve the proposed ACL settlement. Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it. We have a number of in-person speakers and a number of virtual speakers as well. So regarding our in-person speakers, we'll start with Ben Harris. If he's here, okay. We'll have 6 minutes representing both LA Waterkeeper and Gilda Bay. So both times combined. Thanks so much. Go ahead.
And I have a presentation. Hopefully this works. Yeah, is that me? Okay. Good afternoon, board members. Thank you very much for the opportunity to speak on this important item. My name is Ben Harris. I'm the senior staff attorney with Los Angeles Waterkeeper. You all know me, so I just want to start with a quick overview of the main 4 points I want to bring up for this this proposed settlement. Two are kind of more procedural, and then the last two are on the substance of the settlement itself. So I'll just get right into it. The first point to make is just to clarify who LA Waterkeeper is. I know you all are familiar with the organization, but the comments from the prosecution team suggest that maybe a refresher is helpful. So we're a nonprofit. We've been around since 1993. These are our pillars of work that we do. Obviously, what brings me here today is pollution prevention, not just stopping the pollution from happening, but holding polluters accountable. Now, the response to comments from the prosecution team, and as we heard orally earlier, suggests that we have a financial incentive when we're doing our job here to, be the water watchdog and to, hold polluters accountable. That is absolutely untrue, and it's actually quite insulting to suggest that we have a financial incentive. The citizen suit enforcement work that we do under the Clean Water Act serves a greater good. It stops pollution. It supplements agency enforcement. It does not give us any financial incentive in terms of the civil penalties we may be able to recover. Any of those penalties that are recovered would be going toward a supplemental environmental project, or in the litigation context called an environmentally beneficial project. It's nothing that we can pocket to line our own pockets. It doesn't work that way. So to say that we have a financial incentive is just straight up wrong. I shouldn't really have to say this. I think you all know the value of citizen suit enforcement, but I just really need to emphasize that point, that we have no financial incentive in bringing these comments here today. The second point that was made in the response to comments is the evidentiary standard that applies here. I understand this is consideration of a proposed settlement. We're not talking about an evidentiary hearing, but standards still apply. There cannot be arbitrary and capricious decision-making. If this were to go to an upper adjudicator, there are standards that apply that require decisions to be supported by findings and the findings to be supported by evidence. So the representation in the response to comments that there is no need for any evidence is misleading, and that's just simply inaccurate. So now with those standards in mind, the 2 points I want to make first is that LA Waterkeeper believes there is no rational support, no findings and evidence that supports those findings that justifies this reduced penalty amount. We're talking about less than 3% of the initial liability that was calculated. The prosecution team had two main justifications that we saw in that step seven to provide this downward departure. One is a high daily discharge volume across multiple days of violations, which to me means there's a lot of pollution going in the waterway. So it's actually backwards to say that should be a downward adjustment of a penalty for all of that pollution that's entering the waterway. And it's certainly not to bring that down to 3% of the initial liability calculated. The second point is that reliance on this 2010 consent judgment that you just heard about. Really, our position on that is that it's arbitrary. It gives Boeing the benefit of a bargain from a past settlement that was done 16 years ago. There's inflation that needs to be accounted for. It was also based on the stipulated penalties on a forward-looking basis from that consent judgment, which is no longer in effect. So we think it's arbitrary to rely on that consent judgment. And while you heard comments just now from the Boeing representative, in writing, they agreed that I pasted it up there, that Boeing doesn't think it's appropriate to base the settlement on a past consent judgment. They obviously want it in a different direction, but the point still stands that it's pretty arbitrary to give Boeing the benefit of a past settlement here. And I also, again, note that, you know, I put the word double in quotes because in our position, this penalty is not actually double those stipulated penalties under that 2010 consent judgment because it doesn't consider inflation. It doesn't consider the changing circumstances of why these violations need to be treated differently than violations from, you know, almost two decades ago. So the last slide and the last point I want to make is on the deterrent effect. This is really critical here. We think this penalty here of under $600,000, under 3% of what the discretionary enforcement could be, is not going to deter any conduct. In the prosecution team's own words, even a $20 million penalty won't have a financial deterrent, but it does have many other aspects of effective deterrent. If you, as the agency deciding whether to approve the settlement, if you provide fulsome penalties and fulsome violations over slaps on the wrist, that will deter future violations because future violations will then be made with the understanding that there will be fulsome penalties and not another slap on the wrist, as has been the case since 2002. Also, the claim that Boeing's reputation is harmed by this settlement, I think, is backwards because Boeing's reputation, as you'll hear from other community members, is already very poor in this community for all of the decades of contamination for radioactive materials that were used on this site. So I think the way to start improving Boeing's reputation is to hold Boeing fully accountable and not to let it get off with another slap on the wrist. I absolutely acknowledge Boeing has spent the last 15 years investing significant amount of money in its stormwater improvements on site. I think it's pretty clear that that has not worked because there are still violations and there will still continue to be violations until there is more progress. And I think the most fulsome enforcement that you can offer is going to help get us there. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. All right. I have a number of in-person cards for 3 minutes each. Please, first is Ms. Jenny Knack from Parents Against SSFL.
Hello there. I guess I'll start with a basic request.
Please pull the microphone closer to your mouth. Yeah, okay.
Thank you. My request is that you reject the proposed settlement. The settlement represents a lack of willingness to fully enforce the Boeing SSFL MPDS permit. This board's made a similar deal with Boeing in the past. That's that consent order limiting fines for exceedance violations over extensive time periods. And as you know, as we can see today, no greater compliance was achieved by giving them a deal. No greater compliance will be achieved through that type of action. Exceedances persist. They will continue to persist because there's nothing compelling Boeing to take significant corrective actions. This board strengthened the SSFL permit for the first time in its renewal process the last time. The last time we were here, you sided with the people and did the right thing and strengthened the permit. But what's the purpose of improving the capability and the accuracy of the monitoring technology if there's no commitment to implementing meaningful enforcement for the resulting violations? This settlement takes the teeth out of those permit improvements. This board can demand compliance through heavier fines. The issuance of less than 3% of applicable fines will never bring Boeing into compliance. It's embarrassingly performative to pretend that any of us think that that will happen. This board must remain committed to bringing Boeing into compliance through the mechanisms available to you, and that's through hefty fines. Why is $20 million inappropriate? The prosecution failed to lay the foundation for that argument. They have at least $20 million worth of violations, and they should pay for them. There's nothing inappropriate about Boeing paying for their failures to control contamination migration at the site. What is inappropriate is letting them off the hook with this minuscule fine. 5% of applicable fines is not forceful enforcement, regardless of what Boeing says. Their sampling methods, which we're not supposed to be discussing, but they're not in compliance with the permit. Their best management practices to keep contamination on site are not working. They are knowingly, continually violating their permit, and they don't want to pay for it. They want you to give them a small slap on the wrist. We know that they're failing to sample through the first flush, as the permit requires. They have capable technology for doing that. It's not a mistake. It's faulty methodology. It's an established pattern. How many violations would Boeing have amassed over the past 2 years if they had sampled appropriately? Don't you want to know? I really want to know. I want this board to demand that they actually do what the permit requires. And I want you to hit them where it hurts, because none of this is going to change. We're going to be here forever as long as you're on this board, unless you make them pay for it. Thank you so much.
Okay. Next, it's Terin Schmidt or Tevin Schmidt. I can't. Okay. Thank you so much.
Good afternoon. Members of the board, my name is Tevin Schmidt. I'm the watershed scientist for the Wishtoyo Chumash Foundation and associate director of Ventura Coastkeeper. I present these comments on behalf of Wishtoyo and VCK. Wishtoyo commends the regional board for pursuing an enforcement action against Boeing for their failures to comply with the individual NPDES permit at the Santa Susana Field Lab. Our praise for the regional board's enforcement action stops there. Wishtoyo recognizes the ACL as nothing more than a slap on the wrist for a megacorporation that has unlimited resources and has had decades to come into compliance with their individual NPDES permits at SSFL. The less than $600,000 settlement will do nothing to persuade Boeing to come into compliance with their individual permit. The continuous discharge of lead, dioxins, and other toxic pollutants poisons the surrounding watersheds and communities. Wishtoyo submitted a comment letter in January detailing additional permit violations that we identified while reviewing Boeing's monitoring reports. These include failures to sample the first flush of discharges, failures to sample discharge events altogether, and hundreds of quality assurance quality control discrepancies. Boeing is routinely failing to take representative samples of discharge events, omitting chain of custody forms, and completely failing to sample some discharge events. Our review suggests that either Boeing is purposefully managing the sampling of the Santa Susana Field Lab to collect data that is not representative of actual conditions, or Boeing's management of their NPDES monitoring for the site is entirely incompetent. Which do you think is worse? We are also concerned that the regional board did not include any of the additional permit violations that we identified in the board's administrative civil liability complaint. Boeing has a fraught history of managing the Santa Susana Field Lab, including mishandling of hazardous and low-level radioactive waste and the complete inability to properly manage and mitigate stormwater pollution that flows off-site. Every single quarterly monitoring report for SSFL that coincides with the wet season includes multiple exceedances. Each year, Boeing pursues a lackluster action plan to address this pollution, and yet the issue persists. We urge you board members to take your enforcement actions concerning the Santa Susana Field Lab far more seriously. Please instruct your staff to impose escalating consequences for Boeing and to properly investigate all permit violations committed at SSFL between first quarter 2023 and 2025. Please reject this settlement. Thank you for your time and consideration.
Thank you very much. Next card is from Melissa Bumstead, Parents Against SSFL.
Good afternoon. My name is Melissa Bumstead. I'm with Parents Against the Santa Susana Field Lab. I live in West Hills. My daughter is a two-time cancer survivor. She's one of 100 children that we've identified in our community surrounding the site who have had cancer. First, I would like to thank the board and the staff for involvement with Boeing's 2025 CMS document. Areas that Boeing proposed to be exempt from the cleanup were identified for remediation by the LA Water Board in order to prevent groundwater contamination. I would ask now a second step. In the packet that I handed out, you'll see PDF page 114, where Boeing claims there is no off-site exposure pathway. This is obviously not true. That's why we're here today. And I would ask that you please contact the DTSC and contest this clearly incorrect fact. Lost my place here. It's just kind of day I'm having today. So thank you again for that involvement. Please continue to be involved. The Santa Susana Field Lab, as you know, is one of California's most toxic and radioactive sites. Parts of the property are so toxic that according to Boeing's own data in 2015 in an RFI report, some areas would actually give 96 out of 100 people cancer if they hypothetically lived on site and they ate the produce they grew there. That is how toxic the site is. And that is the same material that comes off-site into our local watersheds every time it rains, that toxic of material. The Boeing company signed a cleanup agreement in 2007. They committed to completely clean up the site, to be done with a complete remediation by 2017. They have not begun. And the cleanup that they're proposing now to do will leave 95% of that contamination on site, according to independent scientific analysis. We will be here again after the cleanup, because until it is cleaned up at the source, it will continue to run off-site. BMPs will, or the site is simply too large. You cannot just stop rain from coming off of a mountain. Unless it's cleaned up itself, it will continue. And I've been on the expert panel water tours at the site. I do that regularly. And the last time I was there, I mentioned the fact that we saw in one of the NPDES reports lead at 200 parts per billion coming off the Santa Susana Field Lab into the LA River, 200 parts per billion. And they told me that that was considered beneficial discharge because technically it met some standard. As a resident, there is no beneficial lead in my community, in my wildlife, in our ecosystem. The Water Board had a clear and appropriate opportunity, or has. I actually didn't realize that we were still had an opportunity to try to sway you to protect our community. The $20 million for the NPDES exceedances, it might actually make Boeing consider their actions. I want to mention my daughter's cancer treatment cost $2 million for one child to live. So somebody is paying for the contamination. We ask that it not be us. Thank you.
Thank you very much. The last in-person call is for Mr. Solomon Adams from Wishtoya. For 3 minutes.
Good afternoon, members of the board. My name is Solomon Adams, and I am a watershed monitoring intern for the Wishtoyo Chumash Foundation. To start, I want to thank the board for pursuing action against Boeing for violations of the NPDES permit at the Santa Susana Field Lab. This action, however, is nowhere near enough. For a company worth upwards of $100 billion, this $600,000 settlement is pocket change. It will not cause Boeing to come into compliance, and it will not deter them from further violations, which seriously harm both the environment and surrounding communities. The Wishtoyo Foundation has identified numerous additional violations of Boeing's NPDES permits that were not accounted for in the settlement and has found a pattern of failures to sample first flush events, failures to sample discharge events entirely, and failure and numerous inconsistencies in exceedance reporting. These inconsistencies suggest that Boeing is not adequately sampling for first flush and not capturing true contaminant levels, either through sheer ineptitude or willful deception. Given Boeing's history at this site, neither come as a surprise. Boeing has proven unwilling or unable to adequately manage the Santa Susana Field Laboratory. They are consistently in violation with their MPDS permit, completely negligent in their sampling, and carelessly discharging toxic substances into our communities and into our ecosystems. We strongly urge the board to re-examine every permit violation at the Santa Susana Field Lab and to impose much harsher penalties upon Boeing for their reckless disregard for human health and the health of the environment. Thank you for your time and consideration.
Thank you very much. I don't have any other in-person cards. However, we have a number of virtual speakers. First is Troise Robinson, virtually.
Hi, can you hear me?
Yes, we can hear you. Please go ahead.
Hi, I'm Tracy Robinson. I'm just a community member. I live in downtown, but I was born and raised in the West San Fernando Valley. I grew up hiking in the Simi Hills and biking alongside the Bell Creek and Dayton Creek and the upper LA River. I just wanted to say I'm horrified by the documented discharge of hazardous chemicals coming from the Santa Susana Field Lab. These contaminants represent a significant threat to the surrounding ecology and the long-term health of my community. I believe Boeing should be held accountable for the full fine amount in pursuing a comprehensive cleanup of the site. And as a resident of Los Angeles, I really hope the Water Board will advocate for the highest standards for cleanup. That's all. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Next is Mark Perryman. Okay, go ahead, please.
Good morning. Actually, it's good afternoon. Good afternoon, Chair and members of the board. My name is Mark Perryman. I live in Thousand Oaks, California, and I have a family of three young children. In my campaign for public office, residents have come to me unsolicited to share their stories. And that should alarm every one of you, because people don't randomly approach candidates to talk about cancer unless something is very wrong. Item 11 is not just about a settlement. It's about a decades-long failure of enforcement. For over a half a century, Boeing has violated its permits, and for decades, the consequences have been softened. Let's be clear about the record. In 2002, penalties were partially redirected. In 2007, nearly $500,000 was proposed, half not actually paid as penalties. In 2010, $500,000, most of it was suspended. In 2019, 19 violations all wiped away. That is not accountability. That is a business model. And at some point, we have to say this plainly. Boeing is treating non-compliance and the fines that come with it as part of its standard operating procedure. Because if penalties worked, behavior would change. But the violations didn't stop. They continued. And they are still happening to this day. The board's executive officer's report confirms that, and that leads to a fundamental question. Why are we even considering a settlement at all when there is a clear pattern and practice of willful harm to our watersheds and to our community? Because we need to remember why the fines exist in the first place. Fines are not just numbers on paper. They're meant to deter. They are meant to ensure accountability. They're meant to make it more expensive to violate the law than to comply with it. And importantly, the base amount of these fines is not inappropriately high, given the size of the company, the nature of the conduct, and the long history of violations. If anything, they're appropriate, because if they were truly burdensome, Boeing would have spent millions of dollars years ago to prevent this harm instead of continuing violations and negotiating reduced consequences today. That is the failure. And listening to staff today, it's deeply concerning because the discussion sounds less focused on environmental protection and public health and more focused on negotiating an outcome. That's backwards, because right now the system needs to send one message: pollute now, negotiate later. And let's talk about the scale. In just the first quarter of 2026, Boeing reported over $22 billion in revenue. So when fines are reduced, when enforcement is softened, that doesn't change the behavior. It becomes a rounding error, a cost of doing business paid while the community absorbs the real cost. And here's what should concern every taxpayer: the cost and staff time analyzing violations, penalties, negotiating settlements is likely greater than the settlement itself. Thanks for your time.
Thanks very much. Thank you. Okay, last card I have virtually, unless there are others in the queue, is for Mireya Gill. Yes, we can hear you. Go ahead, please.
Good afternoon, members of the board. My name is Mireya Gill, and I'm a watershed and restoration scientist with the Wishtoyo Tuamas Foundation. While Wishtoyo does commend the board for taking an enforcement action against Boeing, the ACL settlement was more than disappointing to review. The failure to account for numerous permit violations and the generous settlement penalties was nothing more than a slap on the wrist and failed to hold Boeing accountable and enforce change. This includes numerous discrepancies in their quarterly monitoring reports and Boeing's continued pattern of data discrepancies and misrepresentation in their quality assurance and quality control NPDES monitoring program at the Santa Susana Field Lab. I conducted a thorough review of the publicly accessible NPDES quarterly monitoring reports. I found Boeing did not sample many first flush events and did not include any explanation of delay in all but one case, as required by the permit. Over 70% of their chain of custody reports are missing and incomplete, and there are still numerous pollutant exceedances in just 2023 through 2025 alone. With the pattern of misrepresenting data and hundreds of quality assurance and quality control discrepancies, it is dangerous and harmful to the environment and surrounding communities directly impacted from Boeing's lack of properly managing and mitigating stormwater runoff that flows off-site, carrying the mishandled, toxic, and hazardous waste. Boeing has continued to display their incompetence and disregard to the public and environmental safety by failing to comply with their individual NPDES permit and poisoning nearby communities. Boeing must be held accountable for their continued actions. We urge you, members of the board, to reevaluate all permit violations and to do your job by ensuring that Boeing is compliant with the Clean Water Act and reject the settlement. It is time for you to enforce change and to stop Boeing's continued negligence and harm to surrounding communities and the environment by accounting for all permit violations between January 2023 to March 2025. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Are there anybody else? That's a virtual hand.
There's a Stanley Hunter on the Zoom. Okay. I just want to make sure they don't want to speak. Please unmute yourself if you do.
He's online, but I'm not sure he's ready to speak.
Let's give it a minute and see. No? All right, well, we'll move on to board deliberations and questions then, and then if later on, if Mr. Hunter wants to join, we can accommodate him later. Okay. I know I have a number of questions and comments and so on, but would any of the other board members like to start us off? You want to? Yeah. Go ahead.
Thank you very much. And thank you, all of you, the speakers, for your presentation and your arguments. They were clear and gave us a lot to think about. Before I get into my comments, can staff clarify for this board what are the options of actions today?
You can approve the settlement as proposed. You can reject the settlement. If you reject the settlement, you could provide direction that the parties consider re-entering settlement negotiations to see if they can come up with a different settlement for the board's consideration, or you could direct the prosecution team to work with the advisory team to calendar this matter for an evidentiary ACL hearing.
Okay, thank you. And what would the timeline be for that final option?
We would have to, you know, check the board calendar to see what date makes sense. On our end, we would likely need to get a sense from the parties about how much time they would need to prepare for an ACL hearing.
Okay, understood. Thank you. So, you know, this matter has come before this board many times. And something that has stuck with me in the arguments today is the idea that Boeing has some reputational cost here, and that alone is deterrent enough, or that alone plus $500,000 is deterrent enough. So I think the first thing that I want to say is this board and the state of California have reputations to uphold as well, and we are bound by duty to human and environmental well-being. And so as I look at this mountain of explanation, what I am missing in it is how this final number exactly was calculated and how it was deemed inappropriate for the full, you know, $20 million amount. And so I would like prosecution to come and explain just the reasoning for deeming $20 million to be inappropriate for a corporation that is currently valued at $182 billion.
Again, for the record, this is Kaylin Ellison. I'm an attorney for the prosecution team. In terms of how the penalty was calculated initially with the 19, almost 20 million, it was going through the steps in the enforcement policy that considers such things as harm, toxicity, cleanup and cooperation, culpability, history of violations, those type of factors. And the driving component there that made it so high was the volume. So we did some unique strategies in how we alleged the violations. And so we considered the volume for a lot of those discharges in days when there was some overlap, when there were multiple violations from the same discharge point. So that's really the driver of why it was initially so high. In terms of how we got to the nearly 600,000, that was really based on the consent decree. So we went back and looked at if the consent decree had still been in effect, or I should say the consent judgment, what would the penalty have been? There was structures in there of different types of parameters, what the amount would be, how many times it had been exceeded. And so we factored all that in and explained that in the attachment A, and then we doubled that because we did not think that that amount was sufficient. In terms of why it was appropriate to lower the penalty at all, it really has to do with the type of violations is the main factor in my mind of most other dischargers in your region are only receiving $3,000 penalties for these type of violations. So it's not just looking at Boeing in a vacuum, it's looking at the program as a whole and how others are treated as well as Boeing. And we understand that this is a matter of great public concern, and that is why Boeing is being treated differently than those other dischargers with the escalation of penalties.
Okay, thank you. Okay, I mean, I have a lot to sift through here, but I'm going to prioritize and keep it short for the benefit of my fellow board members. Can staff explain where does these violation fines, where do they go?
The bulk for the discretionary penalties would go to the Waste Discharging Permitting Fund. Sorry, I wasn't sure who she was looking at me, so I just took the question for you, Russ.
I did look at her, sorry.
So the bulk of the money would go to the Waste Discharging Permitting Fund, and then the mandatory minimum penalty portion would go to the cleanup and abatement account. So both those accounts are managed by State Board.
And the cleanup and abatement account, what sorts of things are paid for out of that account?
So that is that's an excellent question. In the past, it was mostly used for emergency drinking water. Recently, you heard from a State Board member that they will be releasing I forget, it's like a total of $15 million, but to this region it will be about $2.5 million we will get to implement supplemental environmental projects.
And supplemental environmental projects are not on the site, but around in the surrounding community? Or what are those?
So to follow the enforcement, the supplemental environmental project and policy, we go through a number of steps to determine. We would really like the SEP to be in the general area of the location and would be applicable to the types of violations that occurred. That's not always possible, so we look at the nexus. We can go 50 miles out to find a good SEP.
And what's the general price tag for a good SEP? Or what's the range, rather? I know that's an unfair question, but give me a ballpark.
It's great, and I'd love to answer that. Generally, we find SEPs, people will choose to do a SEP when it's a million, hundreds of, close around $1 million, $2 million, because it's SEPs are not inexpensive.
They're infrastructure projects.
Right.
Okay. So at $1 million, $2 million, that's probably on the low end?
That's the low end.
Okay. Thank you. All right. So
Board Member Christensen?
Yes.
Hi, this may I add to what Russ
answered? Yes, please. Yes, please.
So and I think I understood your question in the discussion of the use of the cleanup and abatement account differently than Russ did. Sorry. Jenny Newman, Assistant Executive Officer for the advisory team. The cleanup and abatement account is just, in general, used for projects throughout the state to improve water quality. And the recent allocation of those cleanup and abatement funds that I think Russ was talking about, the $15 million with a portion of it allocated to the regions, was not for use in supplemental environmental projects, as that is a term of art.
Okay.
Under the enforcement policy.
Okay.
It is used for projects to improve water quality in the region. And I don't know if it makes a difference, but some of the details about the requirements for how that money is spent are slightly different. But the money in the cleanup and abatement account goes to projects that will improve water quality.
Thank you for that clarification.
Okay, thank you. All right, so as Boeing reported here in this presentation, $150 million in stormwater improvements since 2008. My math is not always great, but I think that's the $20 million full freight here is around 13% of the projects that they've already completed on site, right? And if we're thinking about economic benefits from an account with $20 million in it, that seems to me like could get the state of California and truly the surrounding communities through some pretty good supplemental environmental projects, right? I'm saying all of this to say I am surprised and confused that we as the state, the prosecution team, have decided that $20 million isn't really going to make a dent in this behemoth corporation anyway, so it's inappropriate. Let's reduce the fine. It's still so much more than others have to pay, so on and so forth. there's huge history here. This community has suffered greatly. Melissa, if I can ask you, you said that your daughter's treatments have been around $2 million. Correct. And how much of that has Boeing paid for, if you can say?
Boeing doesn't pay for any of the treatment of the people in the community.
Okay.
Boeing has zero financial responsibility because they say we cannot prove culpability, we cannot prove causation.
Okay. Thank you. I just feel like I do not understand enough here. I'm confused. This is opaque. I don't know why we're saying $20 million is inappropriate given the extreme ramifications to the community, the long history, and the amount of cleanup that has to happen. I would also like to know from staff if there's a way to compel Boeing to actually do that first flush testing. Is there something that we can do to make sure that that is not a violation that continues to happen?
I'll respond to that. Russ Colby again. Not every qualifying storm event produces a discharge. So I believe there were 9 qualifying storm events that led to 5 discharges.
Okay. Okay. So I'm gonna leave it there, but I guess what I'm saying is I don't think that we have the information that we need to make a good decision here today.
Yes, thank you. I know that Board Member Christensen had brought up the notion of SEPs, so I wanted to ask the Boeing representative what compelled them not to do a SEP in this particular case. What type of calculation was made in order to not proceed with that route?
Thank you for your question, Board Member. This was not a negotiation that we entered into with the prosecution team. This is just Boeing accepting the ACL as it's been presented by the board.
So you did not consider, I guess, paying for this in terms of providing a SEP to the community?
We were presented with the proposal and were accepting the settlement as proposed.
Mm-hmm. So it was never a consideration?
It was not a negotiation or something that was discussed, correct.
Okay, thank you.
Yep.
Thank you. I also like to thank the community for coming out here. I know you've been living with decades with these injustices and harm to your families and to yourselves. I'd like to thank our watchdog groups for bringing attention to some of these issues. You play an important role in enforcement of the state and federal Clean Water Act, so I thank you for that. I have some clarifying questions about the steps. So we just heard testimony from Boeing that they were never approached. I know we can't compel them under the state water code, but is that normal part of the discussions where a SEP is not even discussed, even though they know that the responsible party knows that's an option? So here they're saying it wasn't discussed, but it's the law, and they know that is an option, but they chose not to pursue it.
It was not discussed before the waiver was signed, but it has been discussed in general. The preference is here to proceed without a SEP. We do recognize there may be future enforcement actions against Boeing, and Boeing has indicated they'd be willing to discuss SEPs again at that time. Also factoring in, we have to remember there is that Clean Water Act citizen suit, so Boeing does have an interest in resolving this matter quickly, in my opinion.
Okay. And then you mentioned the preference of whose preference was it not to do the SEP at the time?
I believe that is Boeing's.
Boeing. So the previous testimony was partly incorrect.
I believe that maybe they weren't aware of conversations between attorneys.
Okay, so just want to reiterate for the record that Boeing did, possibly through their attorneys, did have the opportunity to consider it a voluntary step, but they allegedly did not. So I don't want to belabor this issue. I know this has been a very emotional and experience both for our staff and, of course, for the local community. But I feel very hesitant to be able to support this proposed settlement, not having all the information, particularly hearing expert testimony from interested parties about the enumerations and models they did for a proper fine. You know, I think there's contrasting or conflicting data and testimony that we're receiving, and at this point I don't feel comfortable to be able to move forward without having a full body of evidence in a public setting. Thank you.
Thank you. Well, let me first start by saying that bringing this to the board was exactly the right call, and so I want to thank you for that. I'd like to thank our prosecution team, Mr. Kobe, as always, thank you for your many, many years of exemplary service. Ms. Cheng To, thank you. Kaylin, nice to see you from behind there. And Mr. Bennett, thank you for your presentation. Ms. Moxley, thank you for coming and talking to us and providing Boeing's perspective. We appreciate that. And, of course, members of the community, thank you for taking the time and coming and talking to us today. You know, as much respect as I have for our prosecution team here, which is a very deep respect, I too cannot support the recommended approval of the settlement, and that is, I think, for a number of reasons. As I see it, you know, we've been at this a long time, since 2022. We've had 24 years of violations, fines, followed by violations, followed by more fines. And as climate change affects us all even more deeply, I believe that we'll have even more exceedances. It's clear that a major action needs to be done at SSFL in order to try to stem these exceedances that have happened over so many years, and I understand, you know, the methodology that you followed here. I understand it, because one methodology led to a $20 million number, $19 million, which you thought was too great to impose. But then the question became what to do from there. And then it was, okay, well, we had a consent judgment, and what number would that have yielded? And then you decided to double that. This was a judgment call. I understand it. I comprehend it. However, the consent judgment was just that, a consent judgment. It's from 16 years ago. It no longer has any applicability here, and I believe the board also declined specifically to extend it. So it's not clear to me why we would take a judgment that is no longer applicable and use that as a basis. But I understand you know what you did there in order to reach what you thought would be an equitable result. In terms of Boeing's reputation, it grieves me to say that reputation, Boeing's reputation at this community, as we've heard over many, many years. First time I was on this board was in 1997, and I have yet to hear one person from the community come and say that they admire the work that Boeing has done. So I've said many times that I wish Boeing, as an iconic American corporation, would view its PR issue I'll put it that way, at Santa Susana more seriously. So the reputation argument is not persuasive, and the deterrent in terms of the number is certainly not persuasive. I think when we take a look at, I think, Boeing's revenues, I read somewhere in 2025 was something like $85 billion, right? This would be a 0.006% of that. You spread this over 35 violations, it becomes a meaningless number. I believe that if somebody's making if somebody had revenues of $100,000, a normal person, this would end up being like a 70-cent fine to them. So I don't think in terms of the other factors, I don't think the deterrent thing is persuasive. Now, it could be that one could say, well, you know what, we still think that's the right number, even though it won't deter, and even though it won't harm an already damaged reputation. But still, at the end of the day, I cannot support it, and I would... Now, where we go from here, I think, is up to Boeing and staff. Whether we have, I don't know. You could go try to work out something else and bring it back to the board, perhaps with a number that would be more in line in terms of what you've heard today, and perhaps with a SEP component that will benefit the community. Maybe that's a path, or if not, let's have a full evidentiary hearing. I think you know, the community deserves it. We're all willing, I'm sure, to put in the time and effort necessary for that. But look, again, I say all of this, but I want to genuinely, sincerely express huge appreciation for the work that the prosecution team and our advisory team has done. The fact that I think you're hearing the consensus, right? We're not going to support it, but that should not be taken really as any criticism here for your professionalism, your dedication. We just so truly do appreciate it. And with that, I think, are we ready for a roll call, Ms. Rowe? Let's have a motion and a second.
Move to reject the settlement as proposed and direct staff to come back with a different option.
And Board Member Camacho seconded it?
Second.
I see Board Member Mendez thirded it, and I'll fourth it. Let's have the roll call, please.
Board Member Camacho?
Yes.
Board Member Christensen?
Yes.
Board Member Mendez?
Yes.
Chair Nahai?
Yes.
Motion carries.
All right, that concludes item number 11. And we've had closed session, Adriana, so what more is there for us to do?
Adjourn.
Okay, all right. We're adjourned. Thank you all so much. Thanks.
And just a reminder, our next board meeting is May 28th, and it's going to take place in Simi of California, Simi Valley Council Chambers.
The 28th.
Thank you.